Welcome to 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back. I am Connor Lestoka, joined by Mike Nelson. And today, we are wrapping up the worst book published, at least one of the top three worst books published in 1897. Irene Iddesleigh by Amanda McKittrick Ross. Big wind up, deep breath before saying that one. I think we stuck the landing there. How do you feel about wrapping up this one, Mike?
How do I feel about wrapping up Irene Iddesleigh? What did you said?
Irene?
Irene? I thought when we looked it up, I thought it was they were Irene with the re being emphasized, which is almost impossible for me to do. It is my Ogden, I will fully admit it. Irene Iddesleigh, because she wants it to rhyme.
Well, that sort of rhymes, I guess.
Does anyone look at that
and respect it? No.
Well, does anyone look at it and pronounce it that way without being coached for at least 3 weeks?
Yeah, it's like the old goatee hook joke. Like, oh, well, that's actually pronounced fish because it's the...
Right, yeah.
I thought about doing a pocket operator cover of Lead Belly's Goodnight Irene for the end of this, sure. But wedging it in. Maybe I'll still tackle that if people are enthusiastic. It seemed like a lot of effort for an extremely one-note joke.
Yeah. Well, all that aside, your question is going to be answered thusly. I'm extremely excited by this book. It went in places I could not have imagined. It went in places I could barely understand, but still, once you work it out, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree. It's... I mean, we get a litany of suffering and misfortune in this book that, you know, on its face, it's of course not funny, except it's hilarious in this book because it's, you know, it's like won't be the last time I compare it to The Room, but, you know, the ending of The Room is obviously not funny if taken at face value as a betrayed man blows his own head off. However, it's extremely funny because the creator was so inept, and that's exactly what happens in II right here.
Yes, in II, there are many empty TVs are picked up and thrown out of many rooms. It's amazing. So I'm excited. I want to... first of all, we won't have any real or fanfic today.
Unfortunately, no. But we have your real or fanfic updated statistics. We can tease that.
Okay, that should be exciting. I feel pretty good because I think I had a decent run in this one.
Yeah. You had a series against the Marlins where you went, 10 for 12 and raised your batting average by 0.03 for the season.
Right.
That's things worth celebrating.
My magic number is getting smaller. we said who we were and what this is and everything, didn't we?
We did, right off the top.
Okay, good. All right, so we're covered there. Yeah, so we're talking about this, and I have a quiz about Irene Iddesleigh for you, because apparently it becomes important, and this is hard to know with this. I compared it offline with you to the Quilter's book, where it's so much thrown at you that it's hard to know which one am I supposed to pay attention to. Remember,
which character you mean?
Yeah, which in this litany of characters... is ever going to reappear. And short of having an ebook and searching the name, there's no way, of course, to know this. So at the end, this won't spoil anything, I don't think.
Okay. For those guys, for that subsect.
Yeah, these are peripheral characters, although some of them reappear. Right. So I just want to ask you, this is a little quiz.
Okay.
And you can get bonus points.
So you want me to identify what this character's role was?
I want you to... I'm going to be more specific than that.
Okay.
I want to know, in the sale of the Dilworth Estates, who bought Dilworth proper, the Dilworth Estate?
So Lord and Lady Dilworth were Irene's adopted parents?
That is correct. They fell, as you know, they fell on hard times once she jetted off to... Right. Where did they go on their honeymoon?
I thought they went to America again, but maybe they went to, like, the Lochs of Scotland.
I thought they went to an exotic island and sat on deck chairs. I don't know.
I do not remember who bought their mansion.
That would be the Marquis of Orland.
Right.
He returns.
Right, right, yes. Delightful guy.
Yes. Who purchased Ayrtown Estate? His name is alliterative. I don't know if that helps.
Well, I mean, we have Oscar Otwell. Is that who bought it? With his $1,000 from the sale of Audley Hall?
Well, no, Audley, that's another quiz. It's like, can you draw a map of all the halls?
Yes, yes. Everything seems to be very near each other. It's always fortunate when a character is forcibly evicted from their house, they can go move in with their sister who's nearby.
It's trucking through time.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be Lord Henry Heaton purchased Ayrtown Estate.
And my second question.
Yes.
What the hell is Ayrtown Estate?
Well, that is everyone knows that makes less money. I'll explain that in just a moment.
Okay, got you, sure.
But who bought Howden? That was the third manor from the Dilworth Estates.
Oh, yes. I do not remember her.
I can give you a hint. No,
Pito, the great artist.
You'll remember once I tell you he's a famous historian and the national bard.
Oh, yes, it's on the tip of my tongue. It's Rowland
Joyce.
Sir Rowland
Joyce. Sir Rowland
Joyce.
Yes, Rowland
Joyce. Yeah. It's funny because I'm looking at, I have the poster up right on my wall here of Sir Rowland Joyce, and I just, I didn't put two and two together.
Bonus questions. Who lived at Ayrtown Estate before it was sold?
God damn it.
The Earl of Tuckersham, of course.
Tuckersham?
Yes.
Wow.
Anyway, the Ayrtown Estate covers the southern portion of Cheshire, owns a magnificent hall, the residence of the Earl of Tuckersham, and is not considered as lucrative as Dilworth. This was in, like, Chapter 3. May be estimated a handsome dowry for the son of any rising nobleman in the realms. The Howden Estate, on which are elegantly formed two buildings of note, namely Blandford Castle and Waterdale Lodge, both exquisite constructions of architecture and skilled workmanship, and occupied respectively by Sir Sidney Hector and Admiral Charles Depew.
Oh, my God.
So if you had gotten those, I mean, I would have...
Yeah.
I would have flown to your home and carried you on my shoulder and filmed it all.
Or alerted authorities that, like, obviously I had some sort of deep... problem. Yes. That it needed to be carried out in a net. It seems, I mean, I don't know if I don't remember if I made this comparison before, but I definitely thought about it. It's like when you do a Kickstarter or a Patreon backer level, and you're like, hey, for $100 a month, I'll put your name in the book, Lord Ricksham of Hugh or whatever.
Are you talking about Sir Sidney Hector or Admiral Charles Depew?
I was talking about both of them. Okay. Yeah, and, you know, I'll, for $250, I'll name a hall after you, Ned Blandford. So let's, cough it up, and there we go.
Oh, just amazing, though, because the only reason I bring that quiz up is because towards the end, one of those names came up. And I just was like, what the?
Oh, wow.
You got to be kidding me. And so nice. I did the control Y and was like, God.
Yeah, I've done that multiple times, and it always never comes up. You know, it's always the first time something's mentioned. So I'm eager to see who gets a reappearance at the end of the book.
Another shout out. Yeah. All right. So
that's great.
Shall we dive in?
Yeah. Just one headline. This was not an email, but someone sent it to us on Twitter the other day. A listener named Kara sent us a tweet that said, "When you drop a shameless 372 pages reference into a headline at work, and it's still in the top stories 2 days later in front of God and everybody." And Kara is a writer or editor at Crunchyroll. And yeah, she published a story with the headline, "This custom Hatsune Miku PC is one hell of a rig." So, nice. And Hatsune Miku is the generative thing where you can she's a virtual pop star, and you can turn program music for her, and she'll perform it, and she does concerts and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's you said yeah with a lot of confidence there. Kevin did a song in the style of one of her songs at some point in time. Anyway, so someone made a custom rig for her, and then down in the comments, user Bud G13 said, "I understood that reference in the title."
So someone.
She went out on a big limb there, and it paid off in the comments.
Well, the fact that it works even out of context, is
right, yeah,
a testament to the enduring and lifelong quality of that quote.
Someone commented on his comment, I think after we tweeted it out, so probably a listener, who said, hey, Bud, did you recognize it from 372 pages or for the inflatable fetish forums? And it would be amazing if he was like, what's 372 pages?
Right. Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it is delightful. Thank you very much, Kara, for keeping it going. But yeah, let's jump into the book. Let's brief recap as we get started.
Sure. I'll start with the easy stuff. Irene Iddesleigh marries Sir John.
Yes.
All right, you take it from there.
God. Well, she then betrays him by having a, I don't know if it's called an affair. It's definitely an emotional affair. She was committing adultery in her heart, like Jimmy Carter, with her tutor, Oscar Otwell. John found out about that, locked her up in a murder room of their house. We'll get some specifics about that later, which is delightful. And this is all despite the fact that their son was, I believe, 2 months old. It was identified in this chapter, in this section. And she later escaped with the aid of a horrible woman, Rachel Hyde, and a just blessed saint of a man, the footman Tom Hepworth. They sailed to New York after.
Well, wait, no. Tom Hepworth and Rachel Hyde screwed up, but it was Mary, what's her name, that helped, right?
Oh, sure.
The blessed and wonderful.
She gets like one more mention. Yeah, she goes off and marries someone. Right, you're right. They just both kind of blew it.
He takes them out and does the Three Stooges slap on their faces, where he's like, "How, you idiots!" And the one guy's is an absolute. So the rest of the household, the rest of the, what does he call them? Menials?
Yes.
The rest of the menials like just weep with, but when the slap lands on her face, then they all cheer like it's, you know, soccer team or something.
Yeah, it's so. Very much. It's not Fred Wesley, Brad Wesley berating Tinker, and then the tall guy Tinker's O'Connor, son, who's a bleeder, I think. Who
O'Connor's a bleeder? Yeah, yes, yep.
That's a Roadhouse, very specific, not very popular scene. Anyway, so that's where we are. They have moved to New York, and Irene and Oscar moved to New York. Sir John is at home, sort of growing progressively weirder and Howard Hughesier. But chapter 15 starts off with a little fortune cookie aphorism. I'm not sure if it's true. The wealthy, the haughty, the noble must alike taste of disappointment. And the first time I read that, I thought it was like, you know, the tall and the short, you know, the rich man and the poor must all, you know, bow before, you know. But no, it's just talking about wealthy people and nobles. And I'm like, I'm not sure if this is true. You know, they seem very isolated, much more than the poor in this book against that type of taste.
Yeah, they seem pretty isolated at Blandford Estate and... it seems like they're doing all right for themselves, especially when they sell it off.
Yeah. Maybe she just meant characters in Irene Iddesleigh must taste of disappointments, because that seems to be the one unifying theme here.
That's true, although in the classic, what is it, the difference between comedy and tragedy, they're in charge of their own fate here. So sure. Is this really a comedy? We can get into that later.
Okay. But,
yeah. Yeah, they... Did you like this particular fortune cookie beginning? I thought it was a little weak compared to the others.
Yeah, it's not great. It doesn't really have any metaphors. There's no orbs. It sort of keeps going for a while, so I didn't even paste the rest of it into my notes.
Yeah, no, it doesn't really get rolling. You kind of read this one and you go, yeah. It's like, we've had a lot of these. Oh, the Dolling in Model Land.
Yes.
Where you start to roll your eyes at them and go, okay, fine.
Right, yeah.
But it really picks up steam when it gets to Rachel Hyde.
Yeah.
And,
we should just talk about what Amanda McKittrick Ross thought about her fellow women, you know?
Because
in the book, for the most part, you know, men get a pass for the most part. But the women she just drills down on and just absolutely is disgusted by them.
And she really goes after this poor woman. It's really hard to get a picture of who she was, but this is how she describes her. They had now no domineering inflictor of petticoat power to check their honest actions or words. And my thought was like, you know, women strive to get ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, she becomes the head of the staff, and only to be called a domineering inflictor of petticoat power.
I prefer girl boss. That might be just a touch better than... Man, I bet there's some websites about domineering inflictors of petticoat power, though.
Oh, my goodness.
No eyes of dreaded terror viewing through spectacles of sin their little faults. And she says, this is how she ends up. She had at last been cast on the mercy of a world of icy indifference to facts of long standing and made to taste the stagnant waters of pity, which flung their muddy drops of rancid rascality on the face of dogmatic dread. So again, it's like Mark and Lisa discovering Tommy Wiseau's body, and Lisa's weeping, and Mark just goes, "You did this to him, you bitch."
I forgot.
So that's 100% what's happening here. Rachel was a jailer of a you know, a woman who had, you know, she was not innocent, but you know, she had not had a trial of her peers or anything like that. So not great. She was just following orders, but she does.
I mean, it is, you got to admit, it's a funny thing that, like, so you have a stern, you know, what is she, like, head of household, whatever. I forget what her title is. But she's kind of stern and a taskmaster. And then one day you go like, "Hey, I'm going to throw my wife in prison and never let her see the light of day." Like, this is deeply, deeply evil. Yes. Like, it's beyond anything I have ever brought up before. Like when I said, "Could you ignore the fact that I wrote that check and it's off the books?"
Sure,
you
know? Yeah, right.
And then her response is, "Yeah, sounds good." Like, I mean, that's sort of like, you know, putting an ad in the paper for a, you know, "Hey, I'm a cannibal. I'd like to eat you." Is that, and then it comes back like, "What? Yes? Yeah. Oh, okay." The
phone's blowing up. I like to imagine him having that conversation like in the break room, him just coming in and, you know, filling up his coffee without even really looking at her, just telling her that he's about to do that. And she does the office take to the camera.
Yeah, so she imprisoned this woman. So I guess she deserves a lot of it. But
but tasting the muddy drops of rancid rascality?
I mean, which, by the way, can we get into her writing a little bit? Because after that, flung their muddy drops of rancid rascality in the face of dogmatic dread. Mm-hmm. Don't really have a picture of what dogmatic dread is. And then takes quite a turn. "Until crushed beneath their constant clash, she yielded her paltry right to him whose order must never be disobeyed." So the muddy drops are now crushing their constant clash.
She takes metaphors, like, you know, stretches them like taffy at this point. At this point in the book, there's some great ones later.
Yeah, something was crushed by muddy drops of rancid rascality. So,
but so good. That's her description of Rachel Hyde. But what about Tom Hepworth, the dismissed footman?
Oh my gosh,
he was the very soul of honor. And was highly respected by all who knew him. In his in his presence, every care vanished like snow in sunshine. He acted as a father and friend on all occasions where trouble reigned supreme, and never failed to hear the light laugh of youth proceed from its hidden bed where it too often reposed untouched. Okay, that last one's a little weird.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Youth's laughing in hidden beds, and he's got his ear to the door. Okay, but before that, Tom Hepworth was just a prince of a man and dismissed unfairly and too soon.
I'm trying to picture what she's getting at. Is there a Dickens character or something who's just an absolute saint of a human, you know, hat in hand, always just sort of like, "I'd be happy to do that, sir." Like, I don't know what she's going for.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I don't know. It was like, you know, for $200, you get your name in your book as a noble character. For $300, I'll put your ex in as this...
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, I love Tom Hepworth.
But so he goes to live with Mrs. Durand, who is his sister.
Fanny Durand, sure.
Fanny, yes. But it doesn't last long, unfortunately, because a few months only elapsed. Whilst under her roof, he was seized with a fit of apoplexy, terminating in a few hours a life of usefulness. Which, you know, that's the last we hear of him, obviously. But then the shock of his sudden demise, of Tom Hepworth's sudden demise, when conveyed to his master, whom he revered, brought on a severe attack of hemorrhage, under which Sir John Dunfern now lay prostrate. So that's extremely funny. people just handled bad news much worse in the olden days.
That's what I was going to say. Like, this was, he was this, like, robust bachelor, right? They talk about him being like, he's a fisherman and a hunter and, you know, he's tracking, you know, the rare hart across the wilderness and killing it with his bare hands. And then like, hey, the guy I fired 3 weeks ago, who was admittedly was like 97. I'm surprised he lived that long. Yeah, he died. What? Oh, God, no. He used to give me Werther's.
Yes. Yeah, to me, it seems like he just dismissed like the Harry Potter equivalent of Mary Smith, Maggie Smith, and then like a kindly version of Filch from his house. And so that's what he's gotten so worked up about.
Yes, that is true.
Filch, if you got word that Filch died, you probably wouldn't, you know, collapse onto your fainting couch and suddenly have tuberculosis or something. But a kindly version, I think.
But this guy has done, he's got a habit of it, right? He's had a lot of fits. There's a lot of, I mean, there's fainting couches everywhere. There's, you know, people are just collapsing.
Yeah.
They're going to sanatoriums constantly.
Well, he's ignoring his doctor's advice to, you know, get a change of air or whatever that doctor was. His doctor comes in, says, your condition is grave indeed, yet again, get a change of air. You didn't listen last time.
But I
wonder, put the leeches on you.
That's true. And when, what's his name? The beloved?
Tom Hepworth.
Tom Hepworth. So Tom was, it said something like very obscure, like he had almost run his race, you know, even when he was dismissed.
Okay.
So, you know, how old was he? Like, how old are people living? Like, did he have 14 fits and so he was 37? And,
you know, right, yes.
Just like looked like he was 100? Or was he robust because of his, obviously his interior was so pure and snowy white. Maybe he was, 107.
Yeah, we make jokes about this all the time because whenever we do coronet shorts, I always, in my mind, those might as well be taking place in 1897. So,
sure.
So we'll make jokes and people look much older, obviously, but we'll make jokes about how, you know, someone had reached their life expectancy by 55 or whatever. But I wonder what it was in Ireland in 1897, whether it was, you know, 70, or whether you were still like, no, I made it to 85. I was doing okay.
Yeah. I think if you, you know, if you got over that hump of, you know, you didn't get gored by a bull or whatever,
right,
you could, you could be okay. But usually like a rock fell on your head or something.
Sure. Yes. That was how most of them went.
Yes.
But so this is where she starts sort of talking about Sir John in similar terms to Tom Hepworth. And it's just hard to, it's hard to square with, you know, him locking his wife up in a tower. But I think that just back then, that was probably like his wife was his property. And to AMR, this was just something that he, you know, was obligated to do. It was his right. Because she says, the troubles that visit the just are many. And of these, Sir John had ample share. So she's just saying right there, he is the just man. He is the book's moral compass here.
That's a tough one to square, given what he's done. I don't know how she's making that turn, but yeah, I guess it's like, look, he had one fit of intemperance where he, for what,
a year,
a year,
yeah,
locked his wife in a saw basement and and had a stern taskmaster come in and have her crap in a bucket and, you know, gave her gruel. But, you know, that was just like, come on, all of us have little fits. What do they call it in politics? A youthful indiscretion?
Sure, you know? Yeah. Or like when you always read about, like, you know, a brewery in California is suing a brewery in New Hampshire because they both had a beer called, you know, Hop in the Name of Love.
Sure.
And it's like, well, listen, like, hey, like, this is how trademark law works. We have to sue you. Otherwise, we lose they say we didn't protect the trademark. So it's like, I had to lock her up in the murder room. Otherwise, you know, they'll take my castle. That's just how it works being a lord.
Right. And was I supposed to lock her in, you know, a plushie room?
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, that was of all my rooms. People commented often on how great that room looked from the outside.
Yes, so right, yes.
I was actually doing her a favor.
That was the one they most wanted to have me unlock and show them to them. They could just sense.
Sure.
But so this is, so he's taken to his fainting couch after he gets the horrible news about Tom Hepworth. And Well, I'll just read it. There's a lot of buildup. How the misty dust blinded his sense of sight and drove through the field of fashion and feeble effeminacy, which he once never meant to tread, landing upon the slippery rock of smutty touch to wander into its hidden cavities of ancient fame, there to remain a blinded son of injustice and unparalleled wrong. All these thoughts seized the blighted protector of the late Colonel Idsley's orphan daughter, and being gradually augmented by many others of private and public importance, rose like a tumor of superfluous matter and burst asunder on receiving the last blow relative to poor old Tom Hepworth. Wow, that is some serious business. Next sentence. Sir John in a few weeks gradually grew stronger until finally he baffled his severe illness with Christian bravery. Whew! Made it seem like something really big and important was going to happen there, but sort of hand waves it away with that next sentence.
I was going to say, like, yeah, I wasn't listening during that middle part. Could you read that again?
Yeah, he's fine. He's all fine.
Wow.
Inflate the balloon of drama only to burst it with the pinprick of bad writing.
Although, I think just a little bit later, let me see, I have a couple dumb sentences clogging up my notes here, but I'll keep them for later. Mm-hmm. But doesn't he doesn't actually conquer it with Christian bravery. A little bit later, I think he's just sick again, right?
Well, he probably heard that his horse came in third of the track or something, and that made him collapse.
We get his son,
Hugh.
Hugh is six, so naturally he goes to high school.
Yes, that was delightful.
That's all children do. But while his six-year-old is at high school, under the kind care of Professor Smeeth,
yep,
a man of highest literary attainments, during those 5 years, Sir John was seen to gradually grow careless and despondent. The healthy glow of youth disappeared. What the hell happened to that Christian bravery?
It has to be like you got to have a Potemkin society around him where everyone just smiles, like the Twilight Zone, smiles and says that everything's going great. Otherwise, he just might, you know, fall to his knees at any given moment.
That does sound like that. Like, what? Come on, man. You were... We've described you before. You were George Clooney. You were running around pulling pranks on people, dating supermodels.
Yeah.
Going to, you know, like riding up on your horse to these parties and people going, ooh, Sir John. And now he's like, oh, my son.
Yeah, he gets out of bed. I'm feeling pretty good today. The house is like, nobody tell him about the Crimean War. Yeah. That would be a big blow. Well, so Hugh is 6 years old at high school, which sounds like a movie from the 80s or something. I guess it is literally a TV show from the 80s. It's Doogie Howser.
Sure.
But did you pick up on Hugh? Because I was like, oh, this is the first time they've identified him by his name. Not so.
Oh, I didn't know. I just assumed from context.
When I searched for it in the document, in the very first chapter, it's describing a guy who in my mind, it was Sir John, but it says the entrance to this beautiful home of Sir Hugh Dunfern, the present owner, is planned on most antique principles. So the book starts, it flashes forward.
Right.
We've seen the present and this is all told in the past because now Hugh has taken over Castle Dunfern.
We tried to puzzle that out last time.
Yeah.
Or maybe the first episode where, wait, what? Who's that?
So she's working on a bigger level. She's playing 4D chess here.
Holy cow. Well, hats off to her.
Yeah. But yeah, right now he's just a cheerful, intelligent boy, obviously, because he's gone off to high school. And the book just really messes with time here because he goes from 1 to 6. And then pretty much the next paragraph, he's sending him to boarding school in Canterbury for 5 years. So he's now 11.
Right.
And yeah, the added, he's careless and despondent, but it also says the healthy glow, this is Sir John, of youth disappeared daily since domestic affliction entered his home and wrote its living lines of disgust with steady hand on the brow, which was now thickly marked with them. So he's just turning into, like, you know, Jeff Dunham's old man puppet or something.
Yeah, he's getting the Orson Welles age makeup in Citizen Kane, you know, where it's just like the hair is disappearing under the bald cap, and he's looking bad.
I would have said Johnny Knoxville and Jackass, but that's pretty much the same guy. Same. Probably did those two makeups.
But when he sends him to high school, which, I mean, again, why can't the whole book be about that?
Oh, my God. Guys in letter jackets shoving him into lockers.
Shoving him into lockers, yes. Pulling up his underwear and putting it over the locker door.
Jokingly electing him prom king.
Mm-hmm.
He's played by young Jonathan Lipnicki, of course.
That he goes each week to see him, but mostly he goes to instruct Professor Smeeth that no one is to come in and see the boy.
Yes.
So like, and which apparently is something you can do. So I guess they have tight security at Canterbury High School where no one can come in and go like, hey, kid, you know. So, but he follows that to the letter. So I'm just wondering, is Sir John like handing him like packets like, and hey, do me a favor, buddy. And, you know, slipping the $20 bill into Professor Smeeth's hand sideways, like make sure no chicks or dudes, you know, come around my kid and start sniffing around about my mom.
Yeah. He's like, I will take this. This is really, no one has tried to do this. I've not had to run any security. Like, is Sir John thinking that people are going to do like a Truman Show where McGruff the crime dog comes in to speak to everybody, but then he takes off his dog head and he's like, you, your mom is living in New York with her tutor. Yeah. And they have to drag him out.
Right.
What was that? Nothing. He must have been on drugs, which is why it's important to stay off of them.
Professor Smeeth is, he's like, look, no one comes here. This is literally 600 miles away from Howden Estate.
Yeah, and breakers are crashing against the rocks.
So I just like that we have no idea where Canterbury High School is, where he's coming to, what it's like. But anyway, he gets a good education. Hugh does.
And then he goes off to college, which I guess is different than the boarding school, correct?
I think so, okay. Yeah. I was going to mention, by the way, I was in college when I was 16. I don't recommend it.
Wow.
It's not a good thing. It's not like I was smart or anything.
So we could have Jonathan Lipnicki playing you in the Mike Nelson story, the made-for-TV movie.
I'm just saying it's not a good idea. And so to be in high school at six, I just don't recommend it to anyone out there.
Yeah, there's always a story like that every couple of years where someone has just gotten their PhD or whatever at the age of 12. And it's always portrayed as heartwarming as opposed to just like deeply insane.
Yes.
Essentially child abuse.
But even while he's gone, but Hugh has enormous affection for his dad. And he comes for the homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
And Hugh ran proud and proudly embraced him, who in return stood face to face with the very image of her whom he could never again own. So there you go.
Oh, yep. Uh-huh.
But then it describes him, Hugh, rounded forehead, aquiline nose, hazel eyes, nut brown hair, ruby lips, pearly teeth, the dimpled cheeks, and tiny chin of his mother.
Oh, dear.
So, again, artists out there.
Yeah, please.
Please get on that.
I mean, have to just imagine, the golden curls like Little Bo Peep, the boater hat, huge lollipop, just like, oh, father, it is delightful to join you here.
Oh, father. Yes, yes, that's amazing.
I enjoyed that when he went off to college, we've left behind Professor Smythe or whatever, but Sir John is a personal friend of Professor O'Sullivan. And so Sir John calls in a favor. He says he would prefer his son to reside with him, which is a pretty big ask for anyone. He's like, hey, my kid's going off to college. Oh, that's great. Like, yeah, maybe I'll have him over for dinner, like one of those times. I'll see if he, college kids always like it when someone takes them out to dinner because they're always poor. No. I was wondering if he could live with you.
Yes.
I'm the college president. Yeah, we were buddies in high school, but we haven't spent that much time together recently. This is not. I'm gonna have to ask my wife. She's pretty particular about these things.
Why don't I get her on? I'm gonna get her on the horn right now.
Hello?
Fake phone call.
No, I don't think I would be good. I'm allergic to young boys' clothing. I'm allergic to those big lollipops they're always licking.
But dear, I would love to do it.
I'm as heartless a bitch as that Mrs. Rachel Hyde. I'm like her, if you're aware of her.
I sure am. She's known the county wide. Well, all right.
I would inflict too much petticoat power on that boy if he were to be here.
we can't have that. Well, I mean, you heard it.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I know how it is, man. I know.
Whoosh.
Yeah.
Well, that leads to quite a thing that I had to dive to the dark web for this.
Oh, the what now?
Dark web.
Oh, got it. I thought you said dork web.
No, dark web. That's where if you were looking for a rig, hell of a, or otherwise, you might want to go there.
Very nice.
It is this paragraph that that got to me. The interview between Sir John and his attached friend, Dr. O'Sullivan, was affecting in the extreme, so much so that Hugh, being an entire stranger to such outbursts of grief and not being prepared for such sudden emotional and silent greeting as that now witnessed by him, began to feel an impossible to refrain from joining in their sorrow.
Wow.
So, one second they're eating walnuts and drinking port.
Yes.
The next, all hell breaks loose. And I just had to see how this played out.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. I mean, first time Hugh sees these. Yeah. Bursts of grief.
This paragraph was well covered by reenactors on the dark web. I got my pick of them. But then I downloaded them and then my hard drive crashed. So I hired the players. Because the hard drive was, I don't know. I plugged it back in later and it did work. But anyway, it was too late. So I'd already hired them.
Hard drive restoration. Hard drives have never been cheaper. To restore it probably would have been like $200. You could have.
What am I supposed to do? Download it again? I think I'm throttled at this point.
Your bandwidth is like unlimited. Whatever their cap is, you're not going to use it. They're so expensive.
I'm bumping up against the cap.
The players are so expensive, and it just.
Well, anyway, I don't know.
Quality increase.
I gave them a blank check, and we got the following: a reenactment of the meeting between Dr. O'Sullivan, Hugh, and his father, Sir John.
Let's give that
a listen.
Ah, my dear friend, Sir John, the countenance of care that now my orbs of vision behold cannot fail to impress upon my soul of friendship the dreary darkness of your departed dependency. And I, commandant of comfort, cannot but fail to not apprehend with clouded compassion your continued comportment.
What the? Why are you guys talking like this?
Son, please. So, Sir John, seriously, how are you?
It cannot be conveyed. The beastly burden that...
Please. Please. Dear friend. There. Stiff upper lip.
Gentlemen, please, this is quite untoward. I've never seen it like, and I went to high school when I was 6 years old. Dad, Dr. Sullivan, come on, get it together. Does this have something to do with that footman I barely remember as a toddler? Guys, come on! I...
Son, you don't even know why we're crying. Why are you joining in?
It would be impossible to refrain from joining in tomorrow. Okay, Dad, I'm all right with you.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
Okay, so I mean, he was deeply affected by
You know, I sometimes lash out just the thought of, you know, eating beans and rice for a month because of your blank check scheme. But they're worth it. They get the job done.
Thank you. Yes, I think so, too. And I'm glad we've both arrived at that. Mm. So I will continue to pay them.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Well, as soon as that dinner was over, I believe this is what happened. The president and Sir John retired to a room of seclusion. And the intense relief it gave the trodden and blighten messenger of manhood to at least have a friend who he could confide in, no one could half imagine. Yeah, that was that gave me pause. It's, you know, they've both been lonely, I guess, but that's what happens in those rooms after the walnuts are gone, I guess.
The blighted messenger of manhood comes out.
Yeah.
So give me a picture of this. They have a meeting. Where did they have the meeting where they all, their grief so overwhelmed Hugh that he joined in their grief? Was that like in the kitchen while the people were trying to make mashed potatoes and then they retired to a cozy room of seclusion?
Yeah, after that scene we just listened to was done, that was when they were like, you know, that was awkward. That we,
yeah. The staff was like, I'll just wait here with the... I do have a souffle in the oven, but you're standing by the oven, so I'll just wait.
Or maybe the chef was tolerant of everything, but then once the blighted messengers of manhood came out, you're like, all right, will you take this upstairs?
Take that into a room of seclusion.
My God, come on now.
Go retire there.
But what she actually describes as happening up there is it says, for fully 5 hours, both sat talking confidentially to each other and sympathizing when necessary. So that is essentially, that counts as a Amanda McKittrick Ross action scene. 5 hours of confidential silent talk.
Wow.
And sympathy when necessary.
Well, once again, our bad books always, they include the time when there really is no, you know, there's no reason to give us a specific time.
Right. Yes, exactly.
For quite some time, they sat talking confidently. And then in your own mind, like, how long would two guys sit talking confidentially to each other? Well, certainly not 5 hours.
Insane, yeah. I thought there's another one later, I think. But if we were to have done those as a as one of our patented, if this played out in the real time, it's described to have sketches. That would be that'd be the John Cage version of it. Andy Warhol sleep.
Yes. So that I don't have anything else. I was amused by the solicitors Hutchinson and Harper. But mm-hmm. that was just a name that struck out. I don't think they're ever mentioned again.
Why would they be? That was part of a insane, tortured metaphor. President O'Sullivan, whose well-guided words and fatherly advice had on this evening so sealed the mind of forgiveness with the wax of disinterested intent that Sir John, on his arrival home, at once sent for his solicitors, Hutchinson and Harper, ordering his will to be produced, demanded there and then that the pen of persuasion be dipped into the ink of revenge and spread thickly along the paragraph of blood-related charity, a little off the rails, to blank the intolerable words that referred to the woman he was now convinced beyond doubt had braved the bridge of bigamy.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's just wedging them all in right there. And it says,
you're strapping an analogy to the table and just like cutting it 1,000 yes. times. It's screaming. You're pulling out its teeth. And
yeah, you've got one of those James Bond lasers approaching its crotch. So that's what he was informed by O'Sullivan that Irene had married Oscar. And that's why he comes in and does that to his will. But it says before that, until now, the forgiving husband. The meek advisor, the patient sufferer, the wounded knight, the once attached partner, the loving father, the son of justice, gratitude, and chastity. And I'd said he did lock her up in a tower for a year. There was a toilet bucket. So let's just dial back the wounded knight at least.
The provider of bucket.
The cracker of walnuts, yes.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, that is quite a chapter.
Yeah. Chapter 16 throws it across the ocean to New York, where it sort of starts is it just essentially says that Irene and Oscar are poor as hell these days. They are just, you know, paupers in a dingy you know, hovel, eating roaches and just scraping by.
Shandon Cottage? Is that what you're talking about?
Maybe. Is that that's the name of their home?
Yeah, I love that all the homes get names, and then when they're brought up again, like six tortured chapters later, you're like, what?
Right.
What are they? What is she talking about? And they're like, oh, Shandon Cottage. The little house of Oscar Otwell.
Nice.
Where he took up residence. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a lot of trouble understanding, you know, how he got so poor, what poor is, you know, what the, you know, value of money, you know, in today's dollars would be. Because it says that Oscar thought that he got $1,000 from the, quote, underhanded sale of Audley Hall, his uncle's house, I think. He thought that meant he was a man of wealth for life. And I don't know what $1,000 is, but it does seem like, you know, selling one house and then moving to another one across the entire ocean, you know, might put a dent into that, I guess. But it says, when safely settled in his trim little cottage, Shandon Cottage, please, squandered his trifle in a very short time. And it doesn't really tell us how, but those are the details that I want to know.
Yeah, squandered his trifle. So at one sense, he's like, this is, I mean, we're rich as Croesus.
Yes.
We have £1,000. And then, whoops, I spent it. I played three games of cards and I bought some gum.
Yeah, right.
So we're so sorry, you know, moths flying out of the pockets. Yeah. Pockets turned out.
Wearing a barrel.
Yeah. So what did he not get about this?
Right. Well, then, so then it has this, though. So this is what really threw me. It says, it was only when Oscar was forced to evade starvation that he deemed it imperative to accept an appointment in public school at the yearly income of $1,000. So he thought he was set for life a few lines earlier because he had got $1,000. And it's like, so I was like, so if someone gave me $5 million, I'd be like, there we go, I'm set for life. And then if I somehow, you know, squandered that all on Dogecoin and horse racing, and then I was like, well, I was forced to then accept a job that paid me $5 million a year. It's like, I'd be okay with me, you know, having to get it over the course of a year as opposed to just at a one-time lump sum.
Yeah, the numbers don't add up. Neither does the character of O.O. Mm-hmm. Because so at one second, we're seeing the other end of his flowery notes to this his beloved.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's coming across as like, you know, he's an RA at the college. And so, you know, he's upstanding. He's fine Christian leader of youth or whatever, mm-hmm. writing these nice letters. My dearest, if ever we should be together, and my heart dare not think such a hope, you know. And then the next minute is like, I'll get a goddamn job when I feel like it, you
yeah,
whore.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Hey, I'm not starving. Like, you might be starving, but I'm eating well.
I kept a little bit of that $1,000. I got some Cliff Bars out in the, you don't know where they are.
Oh, Oscar.
Shut up.
Then he slides a note under her door. My darling Irene, if when the wind whispers, it does call your name.
Calls even, your name constantly.
Even as they had to shoot the horse that was the back leg of my trifecta.
And then enters a room with a wife beater and a half empty bottle of bourbon.
But he does. He gets fired from the public school, which I think she specifies public school as like a, oh dear, we all know what that means. Like,
right.
But it says that he got fired on the night of his open dismissal from Wake Town Public School. I'm glad they specified. And arousing from sleep his wife with monster oaths inflicted upon her strokes of abuse, which time could never efface. So that's pretty grim. And I think it says he was fired, it just says because of intemperance. So he is, yes. He's just getting hammered and presumably, you know, coming to school or drinking on the job drunk.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Enough that he had to get fired. I mean, that's, you would think that would be pretty bad at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. Just trying to teach people. This is the numerator, the denominator. I don't give a damn which is on the top and the bottom. I mean, you know, when I was like, my wife was a Sir John. I bet she was on the top. That's what I got, you know. But you kids, guess, go to recess. I don't care.
Mr. Otwell, sir.
Yeah, what the hell do you want, Timmy?
The quadratic equation, how does it work again? Yeah.
You're going to learn that at a public school? No, you're just going to go dig a ditch when you get out of here, Timmy. Put down that lollipop you're always licking. What the hell is that all about?
Oh, mister.
Your curls make you look like a girl. You know, you know who I am? Ms. Marjorie.
Otwell?
Marjorie had a rack.
I'd like to have a word with you, Otwell.
Okay.
I'll see you in my office promptly.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so he is fired.
Yeah, he does, of course. And then goes home, and it says monster O's. It says strokes of abuse. So I assume that is,
yes,
you know, actual,
yes,
physical abuse.
So this is grim stuff, but this is the reaction to it.
Okay.
Next morning, mended matters little for Oscar Otwell's wife. I suppose not. We don't know how hurt she was. Still raging with drunken horror, he lavished upon her torrents of insinuations, which she found impossible to overlook, and which forced her to take refuge in the house of the Reverend Bertram Edgar nearby.
Nice.
I do have to say, raging drunken horrors are often impossible to overlook. As someone is currently doing this to you.
Sure. Yeah.
Chairs hitting the wall, dishes pound near your head, screams of just abuse and horror. Like, you know, I can't ignore this.
Bygones, yeah, under the rug.
So she goes to, what was his name? Bertram?
Sir, Reverend Bertram?
Reverend Bertram Edgar. Boy, that's tough. Reverend, yeah. Bertram Edgar.
I like that he still manages to be drunk and angry, like, as the night goes. So did he just, like, you know, sit back and drunkenly read Leaves of Grass all night until she woke up again, and then he just resumed his abuse? I mean, was he out there breaking dishes and stuff all night long?
I don't know. Did she, you know, like, I hate to be grim about, like, hide in the bathroom and, like, you know, the bandages on and stuff, and then, like, comes out like, are you still at this?
Yeah, that's right.
Come on.
You're trying to pick up the TV and throw it out the window? You're going to throw out your back?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the all-night drunk thing is a hard thing to imagine. People usually end up nodding off and stuff. So, you know, kudos to Oscar for being able to pull that off. That's some power move right there.
I mean, I suppose he maybe had a handle
right,
of bourbon that he just carried with him. That's why the school was like, look, we can no longer ignore the fact,
yeah, really,
that you don't just have a flask, sir. You carry around a full handle.
Yeah, the science teacher, he keeps it in his desk drawer, but you're not even attempting, yeah, to do that.
put it in, you know, one of those coffee thermoses, and at lunch, that's how we do it around here.
You make the children kiss your handle of bourbon as they go up to the blackboard to write equations. It's not appropriate. It's, but yeah, so she moves out into the Reverend's house, and then things escalate very quickly, as they tend to do in this book. Because Oscar does not handle that well, as you'd expect. A few weeks later, found him in utter destitution, which, you know, from where they were, which was accepting jobs out of starvation and drinking on the job, it's hard to imagine how it got worse.
Well, he, even bigger insult, so she goes away, he sells all of their household effects, which Oscar pocketed for their dainty worth.
Nice. Okay.
So I'm trying to picture the Shandon Cottage. What has he got in there?
Yeah, like, I'm picturing, like, you know, Lenny's house at the Simpsons when the wall falls down and he's just eating it out of a can with a spoon. Like, I mean, what? How did they sold already before he accepted the pauper's work at a public school?
So he's, I guess, out in his front yard with his stuff and his, you know, his trusty handle,
yeah,
of
no early birds.
Times. And he's... like, I got a footstool. Give me anything for it. Give me anything for it. I don't need a footstool, yeah, you drunken idiot. Come on, 10 cents.
I got an electric football table. Your kid will love it. Look, come on.
I don't need one. Please.
Beanie Babies? Like, I'll sell them by the pound.
I'm your neighbor. I heard you screaming at,
yeah,
your wife.
Is she okay?
Night.
That's why I'm here to check on her. Yes. She's fine. She's with Reverend Bertram. What's his... You got two first names.
Shut up and buy my Sports Illustrated phone that I got for free.
Oh, the football phone. Yeah, I'll take that.
Okay.
Oh, I can't wait for phones to be invented. Then I'll plug it in and call the next guy who gets one.
I'm going to pocket their paltry worth.
But so he decides in a moment of madness, he resolves to resign himself to that ever anxious defender of satanic rites who prowls about in ambush. So I thought that meant he was going to sell his soul, right?
Like, I assumed that too.
But it just seems to me that he's going to go drown himself in Afton Lake.
Yes, of course. That's the second thing you think of when someone is going to resign himself to the ever-anxious defender of satanic rites. So he heads to, and there's a curious thing about as he goes to bathe his body of perilous adventure in its darkened waters of deepest death. He sheds his... Oscar Otwell divested himself of his scanty attire.
Ooh.
What was he wearing?
Yeah, Borat's bathing suit? I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
Chippendale little tuxedo shirt?
I guess we're supposed to picture like hobo half gloves and a tattered sweater and stuff. So that went down, everything went down very quickly for him.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Like, you know, gets a job as a respectable salary at a school and quickly drinks it away, and then just like his clothes disintegrate.
You think old timey clothes maybe they didn't last long, but people used to put some care into what they were making. You know, we had honorable workmanship, so you would hope they wouldn't just disintegrate on him.
Sure, but scanty attire.
He says a tearful farewell to his bindle as he lays it on the ground. But yeah, it says, in another moment, he was struggling in the freezing element, which soon should shroud his future with robe of blackest doubt.
Mm.
But enough of that. Let's introduce another character. Dunraven Hall was situated only a mile from Afton Lake and inhabited by the Honorable Eric Eustace, a nobleman of unbounded wealth whose extension of charity was both wide and varied in this family that Mrs. Otwell was fortunate enough in securing the position. So that we know that means she got a job there as the, you know, as a housekeeper or a cook in Eric Eustace's house. And that was the last we heard of Oscar Otwell until... Well, I guess it says that she says that he resigned his worldly career, which was a pretty flowery euphemism.
Yeah, so that's the end of him. But, you know, Eric Eustace gets described as a nobleman of unbounded wealth. What we didn't see was him buying and selling Dilworth property over inflating its value, selling it to lords and ladies.
Yes.
And then like, yeah, you know, I made a cool billion off that sale of Otley Hall. Sure, I'll give 1% of it to the poor.
And, yeah, he's just flipping houses, flipping estates. He's just an absentee landlord, evicting people. Yeah, considering what you said about Sir John, you know, the wounded knight, calling someone a nobleman of unbounded wealth is extending charity wide and varied is, you know, probably a bad thing.
Yeah, he's got like six wives in murdered dungeons all over. But he's a nobleman.
But Irene wakes up one morning and has a sense that something as bad has happened. So she goes for a walk and runs into someone who says, oh, madam, the clothing of a gentleman was seen early this morning as David Gillespie, a laborer, was engaged at a drain hard by. And of all the people you didn't need to name, the guy who discovered Oscar's frozen corpse, naked corpse, was probably right up there.
Right.
But she says it was neatly folded and deposited. Oh, she found his clothing. Sorry. It was folded and deposited on the brink. Surely someone must have been demented and drowned himself in Afton Lake. The authorities are now on the spot and refuse to mention who the gentleman is. But she has Irene has a bad feeling and like runs home and awaits the police to come and talk to her.
And this is a great thing because so she suspects this already. The authorities come, and drawing from his pocket a parcel containing Oscar's card, photo, and a letter addressed to Mrs. Oscar Otwell, the officer in charge asked her to read it aloud, which she did in a rather trembling voice. You don't say.
Kind of unconventional.
Like, we pulled a bloated white corpse out of the lake.
Ah!
Yep, I know, that's tough news. We're pretty sure it's your husband.
Oh my God, oh no,
yes,
poor Oscar.
I know, this is quite a blow. Everyone is reeling under this news. It was grim to look at his eyes bulging out of his white, puffy face. You ever seen Jaws?
I'm fainting, yes, I have, of course. Why?
Yes, yeah, when that body comes out and scares Richard Dreyfuss.
It's a terrible, terrifying scene.
10 times worse
than that. I'm fainting off this fainting couch onto a sub-fainting couch. A trundle fainting couch.
Yeah, that's why we have them stacked up in an array around the room.
Yes.
Now, we suspect that he, obviously, that he killed himself. Pretty sure he did it because of you. But let's check. Here's a note. Would you read that out loud to everyone here? Why don't we get the kitchen staff in here, too?
Do what now?
Read it. Just read it aloud. We'll find out. It's probably nothing.
My heart is pounding just like, in my chest. I can barely even barely get
out
a sentence.
You know what it probably is? Is him? It's probably not even him who's dead, even though we're pretty sure it is. But it's probably just a note saying he's picking up some ham on the way home. So why don't you read it out loud?
My mouth is dry. Fingers are tingling. I might be having a heart attack.
It's quite lengthy, so please prepare yourself.
Your partner is just glaring at me as if he thinks I'm to blame for this.
We're pretty sure you are, but let's just check it out.
But then she does.
She reads the whole thing out loud.
Multiple pages of the book, and I was just wondering, like, how far does the policeman get before he realizes he's made a huge mistake? Like, two paragraphs in, he's like, oh my God, it goes on and on. Like, we got to just back out the door here.
The second in command is, of course, like looking at his phone, like a minute into this.
Or just staring at his partner being like, I told you. I just was like, yes. Why? You
didn't... He could have read it first and then just kind of given her the high point. No, I mean, what?
But the my main takeaway from this letter was that Oscar finally and nobly expresses his deep regret for wronging Sir John. He says, yes. Feeling persuaded I have robbed that nobleman who now possibly is pining for separation from a world of shame and sorrow underneath the lordly roof of Dunfern Mansion, I am positively convinced under such dangling dishonor that nevermore can this world of sin extend to me the comfort in vain I have tried to seek. Cast yourself at the feet of him and beg his forgiveness, who loved you with a love unspeakable. Amazing.
Wow.
Just a an amazing double middle fingers on his way out.
P.S. I can't find the salt, you bitch. Where did you put it?
Right.
This is your fault. Your fault.
Oscar also, who else got a bad rap? That Hitler guy. Go cast your feet at yourself at his feet, too. Beg his forgiveness.
Right.
The guy who imprisoned you and Hitler.
So I did wonder after reading that. When did he sit down and write that? Like on a sawed-off stump with a little stub of pencil that he stole from a golf cart or,
Right. Yeah.
His ribs sticking out from starvation, he's drinking pond water to keep himself afloat to write this damn thing.
Right,
so
and also presumably hammered as he was, too. Not just cobbling together the materials, but, abusively drunk.
Beautiful though that it was the same format that he used to like seduce her.
Right. His Christmas letter.
Dobbs Ferry, Friday night, dearest Irene in life. Goodbye forever, and then formatted perfectly from your affectionate Oscar.
He misspells Hedley Burks. That's how you could tell he was distraught. But then the reaction I thought was pretty great too. Of Irene, folding the letter and handing it to the officers, together with Oscar's card and photograph, all of which would prove indispensable for their future use. Absolutely no idea what that means. Mrs. Otwell quietly moved again to the breakfast room and, strange to say, finished her meal in silence. So she just goes and sits down and just plows through the box of Cocoa Puffs, looking at the maze on the back of the box or something.
Peeling off the records that used to come on.
Wow, I wish she hadn't sold our record player for a half a pint of gin. Oh, man. I would really love to listen to Sonny the Cuckoo sing the Monster Mash. That would be a great a novelty record.
Oh, one of the great things about it, though, in the middle of that is, she... It might have been slightly affecting had she just left this out, but the move to the breakfast room and, strange to say, finished her meal in silence.
Yeah.
It's just an odd, suddenly the author poking in, like, hey, I'm going to do this weird thing, but you understand. Goodbye, author out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is strange, I think. It's a weird reaction just to get up from there. But then again, the police did just do something infinitely stranger that got no comment from AMR here. So let's settle down with your interjections.
Yeah, I was thinking about this letter. I'm with the I read I'm in a reading group with some guys, and we read out loud.
Okay.
And there are various levels of reading, and some guys read really slow.
Huh.
And I sometimes I get impatient, like I did when I was a kid. And I just wonder if how was Irene's reading?
Yeah.
You know, did she rush through it, or was she kind of like, should ever this reach your length, I trust you,
you will. Will, yes, we know.
Pardon. Me for the rash act
I am about to commit. Yes, we get it, Irene. The partner is just like...
Since the... What?
Donuts are on you, man.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just wondered, or did she just sort of go... I mean, and did she ever... There's no note of it here. It, like, quotes her reading the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, with no stage directions.
So she never stops and goes... I mean, do you want to sit down, or should I keep? Is this?
Yeah, you've got my rate down here. You.
This next paragraph seems pretty superfluous. I could skip it. Like, nope, read it all, miss.
What?
Come on,
man. As your partner, this is a terrible thing. What it all boils down to is probably how good her tutor was about how fast she's able to read. So,
that's true.
It could be a final indictment of his character and abilities.
What an irony.
Yeah, yep, the true testament irony. That he was the best there ever was, and this is a sad fate to it that he met.
Yes.
Well, so that means that she, once she's done with this, it sort of just things escalate quickly again and says that she's going to sail back to England before they even bury him, I guess.
Yes.
And it says she's hoping to see her son, Hugh, who I think she gets word, or maybe the author just tells us, is 15 now. So that's how much time has passed.
So, he was 11. Okay, 4 years it took him to drink away their fortune.
That's how long he lived with Professor O'Sullivan in college. But no, I think she left. I mean, she was in the room for a year. She got locked up when Hugh was 2 months old. She then left at one. And I think they moved out of Afton Hall pretty quickly, selling it for ill-gotten means. So I think they've been in America for, could be 13 years.
Oh, okay. So that's the timeline that I was unsure of, is how long they lingered before the shady sale of the hall.
Right.
Okay.
I imagine if you're doing a shady sale of a hall your uncle has bequeathed to you, even though neither of us understand what was shady about it, that you want to do it pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah. The construction now of these things that, of course, everyone, when they were doing fanfic, picked up on is getting out of hand. on approaching the harbor of New York...
Nice.
To which she bowed, blinded in tears, and in as few words as possible, he related a short narrative concerning both himself and Lady Dilworth, who had long since been dead. Anyway, I like the combination of that, and that's a great way to announce someone's stepmother's death. It's just like...
Right.
You know, you kind of buried the lead there.
Right. Yeah, and it's just she runs into Lord Dilworth, her adopted father, in the harbor by a coincidence, and it's given, a couple sentences, one of which is, your mom is dead.
Right.
So it really is just like a cartoon thundercloud above someone's head when things are going poorly for them.
Right. I had no picture of that guy. I wanted a little more... story of him, like, you know, after we sold, you were gone, you were on your honeymoon, we didn't want to concern you, but you remember I had 3 estates?
Mm-hmm.
Man, that was a nightmare selling it to Lord Eagleworth or whatever the hell. That guy drove a hard bargain.
I mean, imagine if she had filled in the detail. It's like, yeah, you know, I had a 10-year career as in minor league baseball. Anyway, your mom's dead. I got to get to the Port Authority to get these immigration papers in order. Something like that would have just been, you know, made this the greatest book of all time.
Yes. Great to see you here in the harbor of New York. we just call it New York Harbor.
Yes. But yeah, that's a stunning coincidence. And the last time she sees her father is sort of glossed over as she heads back to her hometown at the end of this.
Which, by the way, this being her... adoptive father. I'm still confused about the guy who lives in the place that was ill sold.
Yes.
Idsley.
The guy who came to not Colonel, but like General Idsley.
Yes. I'm still confused as to what the
Major Isley.
What the relationship is there. But we'll, I guess we'll get to that.
I think Colonel Isley was her father, who was also maybe killed in some drunken brawl. That's why she got adopted. I mean, I think he might have killed his wife, too. And this might be his brother or something. So that might be her uncle who came to buy the hall or something like that.
It has no bearing on anything, as it turns out, right?
No, of course not. She tries to get some money from him at the end. But we'll of course, get to that.
One more thing. Mm-hmm. He's leaving. The father's leaving.
Yes.
He pathetically took his final farewell. I don't know what was pathetic about it, but shortly after, was busy poring over his books in Franklin Street, office number 715, where he was employed as a clerk at $500 a year.
Yeah.
So a couple things to say about that. First of all, he was poring over his books, P-O-U-R-I-N-G.
Nice.
Which pedants will be enraged over, so I don't know what he was poring over his books. The fact that they gave us the address and the office number seems superfluous. And then he was employed as a clerk at $500 a year, so half the salary. Getting very birdemic-y here. We get either $1,000 a year or $500 a year. And I guess he was pathetic at $500. You know, we're supposed to see him like, oh, dear, you know, like, I'm barely scraping by since our days, you know, when you were our adopted daughter. So long, got to go to work at my pathetic job.
He's Bob Cratchit.
Yeah, so $1,000 a year, not bad.
Right.
For Otwell, that dude squandered a pretty decent job, it sounds like.
Yeah, he thought he was set for life at $1,000, so again, you know, $5 million. I'm set for life. Someone hands you $2.5 million. Oh, my God. This wretched pauper's existence.
I'll snuff the candle out. Yes. It's not giving enough heat as it is. It's just a waste.
Yes. Right. Oh, my. I'll have to fill the Ferrari with regular instead of premium.
So, anyway, that's the end. And then she steams toward her home country. Yeah. So,
which I was going to say, it is Ireland, correct? This is where all this is.
She's talking about earlier they I gave the locations. Okay. Is she from Ireland?
Well,
is
it
let's see. It gave an actual place somewhere. Okay. Cheshire.
Okay.
That's in England, right?
Known for its cats, that's all I know.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think it's in England.
Okay. Well, chapter 17 flashes back across the pond to Sir John, and just based on what we've experienced in the book so far, how characters react to you know, bad news or adverse conditions, how do you think he's doing? Is he thriving? He's volunteering, taking up pickleball? What do you think?
Let me see if I can picture his face of youth. Is it rosy? Or is it gaunt and hollow?
He grew more drooped and heartless every year and seemed almost indifferent to life's plowing changes.
Good Lord.
At this point, it's like, you know, are there any bones left in your body or just drooping and etched with careworn lines your ear hair begins to take on the countenance of a dark, cloudy day? Like,
I'm assuming he looks like one of the characters that I draw wearing underpants. Mm-hmm. You know, just like a face is just hanging down. He's got warts and moles with hairs growing out of him. Just terrible. But it does, the chapter starts with this, or it's very near the top, I think. I challenge anyone to make sense of this. The mighty orb of gladness spread its divine halo over many a harrowed home. It encircles the great expanse of foreign adventure and home-hoarded enterprise, and wields its awakening influence against the burthened burrows of bigotry and lightened land of liberty to a sense of gilded surprise.
God.
I literally have no idea what that means. I can't even knowing her style, I cannot twist that back into any kind of meaning at all.
Yeah, I mean, I
assume it's the sun, but I lost.
And then I got completely lost.
Yeah, I don't know what it means.
A good rule of thumb, I feel like Jim Tice did it as well, but you don't need to describe anything round as an orb. It's just you're on the wrong track as soon as you start going down that road.
Right.
Well, Sir John realizes that he's going to have to tell Hugh about his mother at some point in time. Hugh is probably approaching his, you know, doctorate or something at the age of 17. So he's going to have to let him know about their history, their family history. And so Hugh comes back from college, and he was nerved somewhat before entering the chamber of death. I guess he gets wind that his father's not doing well. So he enters the chamber of death with words of truth regarding his father's hopeless condition. And on moving quietly to his father's bed, how the lad of tender years was struck with awe at the bleached resemblance of what used to be a rosy, healthy father.
Wow.
So he's degrading like a guy who just took a sip out of the wrong Holy Grail at this point in time. He's a crypt keeper.
And the reasons for it are, I guess, multifaceted. Mostly that the guy he fired died. Tom Hepworth, the 97-year-old guy that he fired, died at 98, I guess. Maybe just crawled over his 98th birthday. And upon hearing that news, like, physically, what happens? Do you have any notion of, like, does a blood vessel in his chest burst? And so he's just pumping out blood into his thoracic cavity, and so he's sick, and there's pus in there, and like, what is happening?
I'm imagining a cartoon mosquito, sucks out his blood, and he just turns into sort of like a peel, a husk of a guy.
So it's he died of a broken heart.
Yes, like, yeah, there you go. Like,
okay. It's just so, I'm just trying to think of...
Malhumors.
So he calls the doctors then.
Mm-hmm.
And meeting the three most eminent London physicians, if you thought we weren't going to get their names, oh, you are sorely mistaken.
Yes.
Doctors Killen, Crombie, and Smiley.
Wow.
Guys, they held a long consultation. And I was just thinking, if this has not been snapped up as a band name, Killen, Crombie, and Smiley,
and then just
wait for someone to come up and go, yeah, I know what you're...
Oh, that would be amazing.
I get it, man.
You're in the band now.
Yes.
Oh, that would be so awesome.
Yeah.
When you, like, sometimes you come across something like that where you haven't had no idea something was a reference, and then you either watch the movie, or you discover it in a book, and it is a pretty awesome thing, and this would be the greatest thing in the world if that was some prog rock group from the 70s, you know, selling out stadiums with their electronic rendition of, you know, Bach concertos or whatever, and then you discovered it came from Irene Iddesleigh.
So the band leaves, and then I don't know if you have anything before it, but then we get... like the greatest speech, I think, in any book.
Yeah, I want to call attention to this before it happens. It says that the three doctors, it doesn't specify which of the doctors, you know, it says they're the three best doctors. What was the exact wording?
Let me pull up the band again. The most eminent doctors, London physicians.
But so it doesn't say like who's number one, two, or three in this group. So I wonder if there's any...
It's true. They don't say.
But it says, perceiving his son's bent and weeping form hang over him with meekest resignation, Sir John cast aside the bedclothes and, extending his hand, caught firm of his son's. Hugh spoke not a word by order of the doctors, all three of them, lest his father, who was now bereft of speech, would feel the pain of not being able to reply in return. So a lot to unpack here, but essentially what has happened is Sir John has digressed so badly that he cannot speak. Hugh comes in and the doctors are like, hey, it's just hard to imagine, but he's going to get even worse if you speak because it will pain him so much that he's not able to reply. So just walk in. You haven't seen him in months and just sit there and don't talk to him. So Sir John can think, you know, he's sort of in locked-in syndrome. Hugh sits there and Sir John is like, why the hell isn't this guy talking? What is going on? And Hugh just sits there without replying at all. It's absolutely insane.
It's not only insane, it lasts for 6 weeks. So I don't know, are the doctors hanging around and they're, you know, every time the son comes, and I assume he came from London, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know what he's doing there. I can't remember what
Hugh's
killing
it, that's for sure.
Going to school, yes. He's He is, what do you call it? Rise and grind? Is that
what he's doing? He's a hustle bro culture guy.
Yeah, okay. He's the 6-hour work week or whatever. Okay. So he comes in because his you know, dad is like a sack of bones at this point. And on day one, they say, like, you know, they give him the speech, don't talk to him, you know, it'll really embarrass him. And then day two is like, how's it going? It's the same thing.
Yeah.
All right. And then cut to week three. Like, guys, we have to,
it's getting to be performance art at this point in time. It's like that woman in the Met a couple of years ago who you could just go and look at and she would just stare back at you and people would weep.
So at week six, like, who's paying you guys? Right. Like, what is... And then suddenly he regained speech partly.
He probably just wants, you know, this madness to end. And that was powerful enough. He had to have thought, like, something awful has happened to my son and I can't express the words. Like, I can't speak and it's the worst thing that's ever happened to me. But clearly something terrible has happened to him too.
Right. So he gets a new bottle of medicine, which causes him to, on entering the chamber of sickness, damn it, nice. Stop that. Yeah. One morning with a new bottle of medicine sent direct from London, Sir John raised himself slightly on his left elbow and made inquiry about his son. So wait, Sir John enters the chamber of sickness with a new bottle of medicine and then raises himself slightly on his elbow and made inquiry about his son?
What? Well, the diagramming is not her strong suit here. What do you think the inquiry was? Like, why the hell doesn't that little wiener talk?
Yes,
what is going on?
6 weeks? Was that the shipping time from London for that medicine? Like, yeah, there's a medicine that you can speak, but...
It doesn't even specify that he took it. It says someone entered with it, and then he'd raise himself up. We're like, whoa, man, that was out for a while.
Oh, so then, he regains a little bit of speech, and so I guess they, you know, ring the alarm, and Hugh comes in. You know, he was out playing jarts with, like, 13 girls, and, you know... Gin and tonics were being served.
Right. Hang on, I got to go inside and not talk to my dad.
So week six, this happens.
Yeah. I want to kick it off with a sonic challenge.
Oh, please do.
So Hugh comes in and Sir John is finally talking again. Taking his son's hand in his, Sir John Dunfern, after audibly, yet a little indistinctly... offering up a prayer of thanks. So it's audible, but a little indistinctly.
Okay. All right. So this is, and it's to, it says, to him who never overlooks the words of the just.
Yes. So
once again, Sir John, potentially the jailer.
Asterisk above the just and then fine print like a car ad.
Okay. I'll do Sir John for Dunfern. Audibly, yet a little indistinctly.
Yes.
Indistinctly offering up a prayer of thanks to him who never... Okay. Here we go. Your hand feels so good to be able to speak. Your hand is much less bony than mine, my son. I would like to start by thanking your prayers. Thanks to him who has... thank you for my speech, which I have. That you never overlooks the words of the... I don't know. I would qualify as that. Anyway, thank you for this speech. Now!
Good word of that!
Where did you go?
Very good. Very audible, and yet very... just a touch indistinct.
A little indistinct, yeah. Okay, good.
But that kicks off... as you said, a stunning scene where he really makes up for lost time not having spoken for 6 weeks.
I don't know if a book has ever been fully restated by one of its dying characters before.
My God. I feel like it's happened in some of the movies we've done, right? Where there's like recaps of... Hasn't that happened?
Yeah. I guess, yeah. It's... Sure. Like flashbacks of things that just showing it again, not from any new perspective.
Yeah.
But that's what this is. I don't think we get any, maybe some little details that are different than the book.
Maybe.
But otherwise, it pretty much just runs through.
15 paragraphs recapping the entire book to Hugh uninterrupted. As, you know, I guess Hugh is used to sitting there without saying anything. But this truly is just a stunning thing to imagine happening if it's actually it happens the way it's described here.
I think if we were to record this as a dark web thing, or get the players to record it, sure, as a dark web thing, and put it as an extra,
yeah,
it would be like the Wizzo the Clown reading that I did on YouTube.
Right, yeah.
If you could get through this.
The sound of someone descending into madness. All right, we'll take the challenge.
Then that would be quite a thing, because I don't know, is he taking a deep breath every time and like the sun is, Hugh is patting the bony skeleton hand and going, there, father, pass on. That's fine. You don't need, this is too much effort for you. You are aware, my son. Like, oh my God.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
can we take, is there a medicine? Is there an opposite medicine?
yeah. Call London, please. I mean, it's going to take weeks, but let's get it in the works now.
Good Lord.
There's not a ton there to single out. I did like the way that he describes her. He, you know, sort of like, what, daddy, what was my mommy like? And he says, I cannot help informing you, she was the most beautiful and prepossessing young lady I ever met. So that's, you know, is that flattery, I guess?
That paints quite a picture, Dad. Thanks. Prepossessing.
And then this is some good weasel words, some good mistakes were made type of thing. He says, I was therefore obliged, through her malpractices, to shut her in the gaze of outsiders and also from my own. I chose room number 10 of this building as her confined apartment. So he's got a layout here of room numbers. And he assumes that that Hugh is sort of on board with him. He's like, he would know what that means.
I've been gone for quite a while. I don't remember.
No,
also,
it's
like
next to the sitting room, you know.
Right. Also, he was obliged.
Yeah.
Through, so like Oscar Otwell before he died, like, you know, sitting down with another drunkard on a park bench, like, I was obliged to scream at her and shit. Oh, of course. I mean, of course you had to. You were obliged. What could you do?
What was obliging you? It was like the bro code? Is that what we're talking about here?
But he does give this great picture of her to him, and then the comparison is pretty nice. On returning home from Chitworth College, I at once blanked the reference to her in my will and nevermore wished to behold the face that swore to me such vows of villainy, the face that blasted my happiness for life, the mother of you, whom I now earnestly implore never to acknowledge, and who possesses every feature she outwardly bore. She's a piece of garbage whore. You know, you look just like her.
Really, Dad? That's, I wish you hadn't started talking, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And like, you know, yeah, is it a compliment, you know, in this day and age to, you know, when men were men and type of thing, to be like, yeah, you look just like that beautiful woman that your mom was. You're very prepossessing, Hugh.
Chestnut hair and those rosy cheeks and tiny chin.
Right.
What's up with your tiny chin anyway?
Yeah. And every feature too. Like, are we...
Yeah, I don't know.
And so that was interesting to me too, because it sort of says that that he only struck her out of his will after he got word that she had married Oscar from like his buddy at the college. Before that, it says the dreadful news of her conduct irritated me so that I only, in my last will and testament, bequeathed to her what would grant the ordinary comforts of life, provided I predeceased her. So after they escaped, he kept her in her will. He scaled it back. But only once she found out that he had married Oscar. That's what caused her to completely strike her. So he was being very reasonable even once she had fled his premises.
I wonder, I forget what his solicitors were, but I wonder if in his phone book, because he consulted them so often, was he accidentally calling the doctors when he meant to call his solicitors? So, like, two guys would show up once, and like, where's the third? Like, no, we're the lawyers. Oh, right.
Yeah, it had no ranking of the solicitors' estimableness. What is the word?
That's close enough.
Sure. I mean, so did he just, like, were they the type of guys that advertise on a bus bench? They were just ambulance chasers? he spent so much on his doctors that he had to scrimp when it came to them.
I guess so. But that's amazing. So he But it ends. I think you wanted, you liked the ending.
I loved the ending. So, I mean, yeah, so, again, 15 uninterrupted paragraphs. And then when he's done, we get a moment that I laughed out loud because I thought it was legitimately hilarious, even if she didn't mean it to be that way. Sir John Dunfern now lay back exhausted on his pillow and muttered quietly, "Oh, thank God." So he just gets that all out, just like, oh, like an old man grunt. Thank God. And then dies. He pretty much just like, that's his final word. That's his rosebud. He drops the snow globe. That's it for him, for our main character.
We get his death, though. We get the touch of AMR. The next morning, the angel of death was seen to spread its snowy wings.
Nice.
So even in this, you couldn't just get, you know, Sir John died. You have to get was seen to spread its snowy wings.
Right. Is that the passive voice, or is that even like...
That is the exceedingly passive voice.
It's a passive voice through a microscope. It's just...
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's the end of one of the greatest bachelors in all of literature, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got Gatsby and then Sir John. That's the most estimable of bachelors.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 18, we got two more.
Yeah, these are, I mean, they get, well, this one's not shorter, but yeah, we will dive in.
A lot happens. And it begins in, I don't know if it's a joke or not, but a lot of people pointed it out, the way it starts, the night was dark and tempestuous.
I have to tell you a strange coincidence. I went to a friend's house, and he said, "What have you been up to?" I said, "I got to read this, the end of this book." I described it. He's like, "What in the name? What are you doing?"
Yeah,
right. He goes, "So what?" I said, "No, no, it's kind of famous." And he goes, "Oh, is it? It was a dark and stormy night."
Huh.
And I said, "Yeah, I mean, I think." And I had yet to read that. Wow. I got home an hour later, and that I read it. And I sent him the text, and I sent him the picture of the page.
Nice.
He's like, "Holy moly, nailed it!" Yeah.
So I think that was from like 50 years before this, or 60. So I don't know if it had its reputation yet, if the Inklings were laughing it up about that one yet. So do you think this is a coincidence, or her own little joke, or if that's just a thing people used to say?
I don't think it's a joke.
Yeah.
I think it's probably...
Why start now?
Yeah, she heard it and just couldn't avoid it. It would be a weird joke.
It's like
then she goes on to describe the night.
Yes,
and everything.
Yeah. It's like a college student or a high school student sort of like rephrasing Wikipedia so it's not technically plagiarism, you know, putting it in your own words.
Yeah, I think that I've probably said it on this podcast before that when I was young and was writing creative writing, I would always like... Someone awoke with a start because I read that somewhere and thought, well, that's a good way to start a chapter, right?
Yeah.
Someone going, oh, and waking up, and then you get to like your character's right in the middle of everything. So I did it, and a teacher was like, don't do that.
Right.
So I think maybe that's just the same thing. Like it sounds like something, you know.
Yeah.
If it wasn't a cliche, it's not terrible.
Right.
Because, you know, it's a dark night and it's stormy. Like, that sets the stage.
Sure, you could imagine quickly. Some Shakespeare character saying something that's along those lines.
Right, right. But amazing that she uses it here.
And then, so, Irene is back on the continent, I guess. Or is she in England? I forget. It's England, right?
Yes, she's back in England.
She is wandering around, and she ends up at Tom Hepworth's sister's Fanny's house.
this one, it took me a while to untangle.
Yeah, I'd said you'd be forgiven for throwing the book across the room at this point in time.
Fanny Durand, the aged sister of the late Tom Hepworth, and then... And this is in that same sentence. The twofold widowed wanderer with trembled step faltered to the door of uncertain refuge and tapping against it with fingers cold and stiff on such a night of howling wind and beating rain asked in weakened accents the woman who opened to her the door.
Oh, my God.
If she could be allowed to remain for the night, sentence not over, a request that was granted through charity alone.
Delightful.
So through all of that, you're supposed to understand that she knocked on Fanny Hepworth's... No, Fanny...
Durand. Mrs. Durand.
the aged sister of the late Tom Hepworth. She knocked on her window and said, "Hey, can I stay for the night?" And she doesn't seem to know who she is. She's just like, "Well,
yeah.
I guess on this night, anyone can stay."
This is something that probably happened more often. It's just someone, you know, a traveler showing up at your door that you were, you know, deigned to extend charity to.
Yes, and then you have a beloved footman who then gets to take care of her. So there's no, it's no skin off your ass. Like,
yeah.
Sure, I guess.
When Mrs. Durand came back, I was just like, oh man, like at least, you know, novels like fantasy novels, Game of Thrones, when they throw people at you like this, they keep coming back up. If someone gets a name, you at least can tell that they're going to be, you know, part of the story as it keeps going.
Mm-hmm.
But this book, there's so many false ones thrown at you, the solicitors, the doctors, the castle purchasers, that for her to come back and play a part in this, in the end game of the book was unacceptable.
Let me pull his name out here. Henry Hawks. Is that a name you're familiar with?
Bruce Willis movie from the early 90s?
No, he's the head gardener over at
okay.
at the Marquis of whatever's place. Anyway, it just amused me that he got a full mention. And it's like, is he coming back? Was he someone else? Like, nope. Just a gardener's name.
Yeah, but he could have. I mean, if Fanny Durand is coming back, you know.
Yes, Fanny Durand is
alternate
back
universe.
Big time.
But I also enjoyed how now Irene is essentially just referred to as like the widow or the twice widowed. Like that's now her identity. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Now she's just kind of wandering around like Miss Havisham or something, right? She's just like a ghost of a person. Mm-hmm. Like we're supposed to imagine, you know, Bernard Herrmann music, like mournful stuff. And then black and white long shots of like a lone figure wandering down alleys,
yeah.
You know, looking at, I guess.
Yeah. Peering in through windows type of thing.
Yeah, rubbing, you know, her half glove to smear the frost off the window and look in at the picturesque scenes inside. So she goes to, first of all, of course, Fanny Durant's. And then a couple days later.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if Fanny is like, how long were you?
Fanny's running the vacuum like at all hours to try to give her a hint.
Yes.
But yeah, she stays there for several days and then works at the nerve to visit Dunfern Castle. And as she leaves, she tells Fanny Durand, "Hey, don't expect me for dinner," which I had, you know, Fanny Durand had the double middle fingers out as soon as the door slammed shut. Expect this for dinner.
She also, it says, partaking of a very light breakfast, she told her not to expect her for dinner. So it's like, oh, so I'll put the milk away and the cereal and, okay, and I won't make you dinner. Okay.
Got it. Yes. Man.
Good riddance.
Yeah, she deserves
so
everything.
Then she goes to, this is another great, marching down the hill's face, she soon set foot on the main road that led to Dunfern. So I guess we get a little picture there fairly close.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this, which made me laugh out loud, being admitted by Nancy Bennett, a prim old dame. And again, stop right now. Make the book about the prim old dame Nancy Bennett, and I'm a fan for life.
Yep.
But that's the only mention of Nancy Bennett.
Yeah, Nancy and Fanny's wine night, like, you know, gossiping about their dead husbands. That'd be amazing.
Oh, my God. Yes, of course.
But so Nancy Bennett answers the door, but then I think the footman talks to her, like the whoever replaced Tom Hepworth.
Hepworth, yeah.
And so I like this. Irene asks where the, you know, lord of the house is, and he says, "Madam, if you cast your eyes thence," here the sturdy footman pointed to the family graveyard lying quite adjacent, in which the offcast of effrontery had oftentimes trodden, "you can with ease behold the rising symbol of death which the young nobleman Sir Hugh Dunfern has lavishly and unscrupulously erected to his fond memory." So I want to do that the next time a person knocks on my door and says, "Hey, hate to bother you, but I'm doing your neighbor's gutters, so I was wondering if you needed anything here," and I could just...
sir, you say you are a gutter salesman?
Yeah, just so your neighbor's having him. So it's
if cheap. You cast your eyes thence.
Cast my eyes where?
You, there.
Thence.
To the family graveyard.
Oh, yeah.
It's lying quite adjacent. I don't understand why you're having trouble seeing it.
Oh, well, I do power washing, too, so if any of those need to be...
You can with ease behold the rising symbol of death, which the young nobleman, Sir Hugh Dunfern, has lavishly and unscrupulously erected
to its fond memories are. And so I bid you good day.
I got some meat in my car, too.
I don't need meat either. That's...
yeah, it might deter him. You know, that might have an effect of that. Especially...
I wonder, the pointing where he points to the graveyard quite adjacent, I hope that that was like a good... like 10 seconds of like messing with his sleeve, you know, to get his arm freed up to point with his white glove.
He wasn't expecting to do it.
He's like looking
morning,
at his, excuse me, it's right over there. So.
I think the next time someone does do that, like, hey, your driveway's in bad shape, I'm going to be like, hey, let me get my footman. He's going to handle this matter for me.
Yes. And it's quite a while. The guy standing outside the open door as he hears like the other sounds of like, Jerry, where did you put the vacuum cleaner, the one with the face on it that amuses me? Like, it's downstairs.
Come back dressed in my footman's costume, obviously the same person he was talking to before.
Oh, that was good.
But he goes to look at the tombstone then, or I'm sorry, Irene goes to look at the tombstone. I was back still in our sketch there. And there is a, I mean, what's normally in a tombstone? Just like, you know, name, years, maybe like one thing, like father and friend to all type of thing.
I can only assume that this tombstone was like those you know, posters at a Spencer's Gift or something where there's hinges on them and you have to flip them or something.
Yeah,
because
it's
this
the
is
ABCs
amazing.
Of drinking your freshman year in college type of thing. Like A is for alcohol, B is for the bathroom where you puke.
Yeah, what? How is this possible?
It's a 7-stanza poem carved into this tombstone. I mean, I suppose it could just be a comically, you know, it's like a Stonehenge rock.
But they're also, the stanzas are labeled with numbers, too.
Yes, yes.
So what kind of real estate are we talking about here?
I said that the stonemason's fee alone could have kept Oscar in bourbon for over a year.
Right. It's amazing.
And it's, you know, I didn't take a lot away from the poem. It's
no, the poem's just
pretty
terrible.
Trite garbage.
Just garbage.
I'll read one stanza of it, just the first one for people who are playing along at home. The hand of death hath once more brought the lifeless body here to lie until aroused with angel's voice, which calls it forth no more to die. So, I mean, it's terrible, but it's nothing. It's not super funny.
Yes, it's not funny, but I wondered in editing... As you're, you know, the stonemason going like, you sure, you know, chapter or stanza 6. Mm-hmm. Then when the glorious morn shall wake each member in this dust of ours to give to each the sentence sure of everlasting princely power. You're going to stick with that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, not a great rhyme, but it slants, you know.
That is $180 alone, that one there. And the fact that I have to fit it in front of stanza 7 is going to cost you another $285. So I just want to make sure I lay chisel to stone.
Is there like a cheaper font we can use? You know,
the font is the font because we're talking like 12-point font to get this on a tombstone.
It's going
to
be hard to read.
And that I got to bring in a guy from London. That is 6 weeks.
Well, can he
for
bring
sure.
some medicine with him when he comes?
I'm not aware of that. I'd have to call.
Well, yeah, this is not good.
I'm
going to have to sell Blandford Hall, take out another mortgage on it. This is his dying wish, you know, and I couldn't say no because the doctors advised me not to speak to him. So he said, I want 7-stanza poem and 12-point font on my tombstone. And I had to sit there and be like, this is going to ruin the family, but I couldn't say no.
Okay, I got it. One last question and then I'll sign the bill and hand it to you.
Yes, please.
The hand bill. Do you want these letters gilded?
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, it's my father, you know, it's my father, right? He was a prince of a man.
Okay.
Slave.
All right. Hank, yep. You want some gilded.
Oh.
What? Gilded? You can't at that font. You can't gild it. He wants some gilded. All right. I got to talk to my guy. I'll get back to you.
There's no Hank, is there?
No, okay. Hank is me.
All right. Hey, I do that too when solicitors come to my door. I pose as my footman.
Sure.
Oh, but yeah, that's a stunning thing for her to have to go and then read after the footman told her to sort of get the hell off his doorstep. She goes and reads that. And then
cop was behind her telling her to read it out loud.
But then Hugh finally approaches her and it's just like, what's going on? Why do you, who is this person here? So it's like, is there going to be a tearful reunion with the mother he never knew? No, there is not. Hugh goes into beast mode here. Utterly savage. It's incredible. I'll just read some of the...
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Mighty heavens, exclaims Sir Hugh Dunfern. Are you the vagrant who ruined the very existence of him who you now profess to have loved? You, the wretch of wicked and willful treachery, and formerly the wife of him before whose very bones you falsely kneel? Are you the confirmed traitress of the trust reposed in you by my late lamented dearest and most noble of fathers? Are you aware that the hypocrisy you manifested once has been handed down to me as an heirloom of polluted possession and stored within this breast of mine, which very much resembles yours, I've been told, an indelible stain for life, or, I might say, during your known and hated existence? False woman, wicked wife, detested mother, bereft widow, woman of stray sin and stray companion of tutorism, which is pretty damn funny, I would say.
And then he, false woman, wicked wife. He turns around like, where'd you go? Yeah. Oh, she's like a quarter mile away by this time.
Yeah, I don't have to sit there and take this. It's like someone on a roast, you know, they're slapping their knee if they're the victim of the roast while this is happening. But this is all just pretty harsh stuff.
She's wearing those giant sunglasses and her mascara is just like completely ruined at this point.
We also just imagine her being like, I was actually just here with the DoorDash delivery, sir.
Yeah, but another one of those, an entire, monologue, like very, very long monologue with no reaction in the middle of it.
Yeah, it says
no,
it.
Like, but, yeah. And then, you know, an M dash.
I am talking. You know, no, yes. Like, wine thrown in his face like a Real Housewife would. Yeah. It even acknowledges it. It says, speechless, you don't say, and dogged, did the dishonored mother steal forever from the presence of her son. So that's an amazing only interaction that she will ever have. It's, you know, he just berates the hell out of her, and then she steals away.
And then she strolls on down. And again, I'm picturing these estates are like in a little triangle, a mile and a half away from each other.
Yeah, they're all within walking distance. They're all, you know, fortunately close because people need to be able to travel back and forth.
She goes to Audley Hall, which I confess once again I had to look that up.
Well, that was it was the house she lived in and Oscar sold.
Yes, with two. How did he do it, by the way? He didn't own it, but he's like, can I sell you the Brooklyn Bridge?
I guess so, yeah. It's Florida swamp.
But then he had to contact the real owners or something. It's kind of like when, you know, at Riff Tract or something, occasionally you'll buy a movie from someone who doesn't actually own it.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, right, yeah. What was your game here? Okay.
Yes. So then you just have to buy it again from the actual owner. So maybe that's what he was doing. But she knocks loudly twice before any attempt was made to open the door, which is odd. I guess we're just supposed to get the idea of, like, you know, the TV is blaring The Price is Right or something. Like, come on, man.
Well, what does she normally do? She typically just goes and expects someone's going to come. Like, you know, the second knock is really what she's calling attention to here.
I guess that's supposed to be like an affront to him. Like, yeah, stop your knocking. Like, I knocked twice. is Major? Oh, damn it! Stop me up again.
It doesn't matter.
Idsley.
Who cares? Idsley. Idsley.
Idsley. But okay, Idsley.
Yeah,
I said Lay.
Irony. Idsley. I think.
Idsley. Ask the saddened widow. Oh, madam. He has been dead almost 12 years, and since then no one has occupied this hall save me, who am the caretaker. The Marquis of Orland was deceived by his nephew, who sold it in an underhanded manner to the major, and he resolved that never again would he allow it to be occupied since the major's death by any outsider. In other words, he just spit on her feet. And told her to go to hell.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know it. He doesn't know it's her.
Right. Yeah. And he's he admits the guy there that he lives alone. He's like, I enjoy. But he's just takes this opportunity. I guess he doesn't talk to a lot of people. He takes this opportunity to get some good jabs in. And yes. Irene has to start wondering if he's getting punked at this point in time. Like, her uncle's been dead for 12 years. Her husband has this huge tombstone. Her son berates her. But this guy... Well,
can I just ask one question before you get into this? Uh-huh. Why isn't it just Major? Why does it have to be a second guy? Like, Major wouldn't recognize her from a hill of beans. Like, who gives a shit? Like, why is it a second guy who's then like, well, I'm not him.
Well,
but if he were here, he would say.
Well, he dies because she's hoping that he'll have left her something in his will as his only surviving relative. But this guy just says, oh, now he took that broad out on his deathbed and said to just take all the money and build that church over there. So it is just more just like, you know, and now we're going to bring this seal out and club it in front of you type of thing.
Okay. I'm just saying that could have been done by the guy.
Right.
Who's like, if I ever meet that woman, you know, I would. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But
so his jabs are, he says, I have always been accustomed to living alone, being an old bachelor, and wish to remain so. It's better to live a life of singleness than to torture both body and soul by marrying a woman who doesn't love you, like the good Sir John Dunfern. So yeah, he doesn't know who she is, and she's just saying this out of the blue. She eventually ran off with a poor tutor and brought the hairs of hoary whiteness of Sir John Dunfern to the grave much sooner than in all probability they would have had he remained like me. So Irene's just like looking around for the camera, being like, can I just talk to anyone who doesn't think this is the greatest guy in the world?
Look, I'm going to knock on your neighbor's door and hope that that's not a person who will then spend 15 minutes insulting me.
He opens the door. I'm just watching a 10-part documentary about Sir John Dunfern, you know? All right.
Okay. So, yeah, apparently this guy who I assume just eats TV dinners and lives in the Audley estate. And who just wants to be a bachelor?
Yeah.
Just because there's no way that he would ruin himself with a woman? Like, what kind of a rich life is this guy leading? He doesn't even have a PS4 or anything. He's just like...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is it. I have two potatoes and I don't have to share them. No, if I was married, that wife would want one. And wow, it's just great to have two.
So, yeah, he scratches his jockey shorts and closes the door, and then that's it.
Yep, peels off the cellophane of his hungry man, laments that the fruit compote got in with the green beans.
What a life.
The only other thing I have in this chapter was just as she was walking to this guy's house, it says she heard the approach of horse's feet and stopping to act the part of Lot's wife, gave such a haggard stare at the driver of the vehicle as caused him to make a sudden halt. How haggard was this stare?
That's a pretty haggard stare.
Yeah, I mean, he screeches the brakes on his horse carriage because the stare is so haggard. I mean, it's just probably a testament to her beaten downness, but I mean, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah. All right. I think the final chapter. The
final chapter is finally here. Chapter 19 of II.
Which it looks like, as you look at it just in size, looks like a little coda, but it contains some very nice treasures.
It does.
it's pretty hilarious.
Does it start with the fortune cookie? I didn't write one down.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Well,
hope sinks a world of imagination. It, in almost every instance, never fails to arm the opponents of justice with weapons of friendly defense and gains their final fight with peaceful submission.
And how does that relate to what we've just spent, 3 weeks discussing here?
I'll say it again. If you're not reading along, if you are, you know it's in front of your eyes and you can't believe it either. It, in almost every instance, never fails to arm the opponents of justice with weapons of friendly defense and gains their final fight with peaceful submission.
It's terrible, obviously. My only, my nitpick is if you're opposing justice, can your weapons really be friendly? I'm not sure how that... I have no idea how it relates to all this, but there's where I would start the editing process.
Yeah, also, I assumed if you're going to misuse or switch up the metaphor that you would, she does that often in the service of alliteration, but this one isn't even alliteration. So there was no reason to fumble that one.
Someone, we did a meme contest on Patreon and someone posted one of the memes, which was, you know, Anakin and Amidala in the meadow, that format. And that Anakin was labeled as a semicolon. And Amidala's like, you're going to end the sentence, right? You're going to end the sentence, right?
Nice.
But not, we get, it starts with that, but that is of course bearing the lead, which is that the next morning. So this is after the next day after the guy has said he enjoys his bachelor life. After the trying adventures of the lonely outcast was the scene of wonder at Dilworth Castle. Henry Hawks, our favorite head gardener under the Marquis of Orland, on approaching the little summer house in which Irene Iddesleigh so often sat in days of youth, was horrified to find the dead body of a woman, apparently a widow, lying prostrate inside its mossy walls. Now, how is that apparent? He just like he pokes it with a stick and is like, oh, this is a widow, I see.
Oh, man. The body is cold and stiff, we find out later. So yes. Is that part of it? Like, well, widows, they go stiff pretty quick. So yeah, this is definitely a widow.
It's got that stink about it. Yeah. Good. It does say she lay cold, stiff, and lifeless. If you're not reading, complete the metaphor. She lay cold, stiff, and lifeless as, what do you think it says, people at home? As a fallen tree, as a slab of cement, as Nero, famed fiddler while Rome burns, Emperor Nero. I don't know if that was just a expression that sort of fell out of favor as we got further and further away from that. But that's
that well-known, cold, stiff, lifeless person.
I mean, it was only a few years before this book was written. It's way in the distant past now, but this was still like one of four things that had happened, so they were still referencing it.
That's true. So this was, I guess, the building that Sir John heard her doing Italian music in.
Consorting, the first time he caught them. Excuse me?
Yes, yeah. So that I think this is supposed to have significance, but
She went back to the house where she like met her love for the first time.
Yes, and as it says here, this is what I'm trying to figure out. She was suicidal.
Yes,
it says that. So she comes to this house, which is, you know, lived in. I mean, at least the grounds are lived in. I could check back in my notes about who exactly lives here now. I have the bill of sale in my notes here. But people, you know, presumably this is, you know, Howard, what's his name? Howard Hawks? No.
Howard Hughes?
Henry Hawks. Oh. Henry Hawks is, you know, doing the weed whipper on this place every other day.
Well, he's employed by Hugh, who, you know, berated her. I mean.
Yeah, the Marquis of Orland. So he's doing the cottage every couple days. He's mowing the lawn. He's got to water the ficus and whatever. But she's suicidal, so she goes there to die of starvation. That's what she wandered there to do as a suicidal person.
And you know,
so how's that plan? You know, she'd like hide when he comes around and is like, I know you're in there. I've got some muffins. Like, no,
never.
I'm committing suicide.
Well, you laugh, but it worked perfectly. She died of starvation overnight. She had been eating. She had that scanty breakfast at Fanny Durant's house. And I guess that was the last thing she ate, which was, you know, the day before. So she really, I don't know, metabolism must be crazy on her.
But she had stayed at Fanny Danford's house, she said, until she restored her health and everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we said, she was plowing down the, you know, Cocoa Puffs and stuff and seemed fine. But then she's suicidal, so she goes, I'm going to go to this cottage, not eat dinner, and therefore die of starvation?
It's
right? Is that's the timeline?
Yeah, just like Nero.
Of course.
But no, that is the timeline.
Okay, now I understand.
We parsed this out because it was so absurd, but it says, I mean, the chapter says Henry Hawks, the next morning after the trying adventures of the Lonely Outcast, discovers the body. So it is sort of like if you've ever, you know, had a cold or just like gone to bed without supper, that's that could happen to you anytime. You could starve to death overnight.
Okay, so does that mean, so that's the second paragraph of this final chapter. The next morning means the next morning after chapter, the previous chapter?
After the trying adventures of the Lonely Outcast, yeah. And that was her going to the store, to the both houses, reading the tombstone. I mean, that's all that could be. It's all it could mean.
Yeah, of course. Okay. You know, I just wanted to make sure there was no out, like she didn't say the next morning. Because, you know, she has the fortune cookie, the full paragraph of fortune cookie sort of clouds the beginning of the chapter. Yeah. But the real beginning of the chapter is the next morning.
Yeah.
Right? This might as well be in italics, the fortune cookie.
Yes, like yes.
The darling piece. Yes.
Yeah, okay. No, I don't think it's unclear at all. I mean, and that's why I've started sleeping with a pouch of pizzeria pretzel combos in my bedside stand so I could wake up and have a few in the middle of the night so I... You know,
you do not want to. I mean, are you? Life is going good for you, so you're. Maybe you have to have a suicidal mind as you.
Okay.
Deliberately go to bed with no supper.
Starve. Yeah. Just be like, all right, boys, we're shutting it down. Everyone on the inside's like, here, like, boop.
Guys are doing the protests, the not eating starvation protests are like, nah, it's going to take you at least 35 days. Oh, you did it. Wow. Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. They're the people who are leading those protests are like, you can't be more like Irene. Look at her. Yeah. It's a 4-year-old's understanding of how that might work thrown in here at the very end, or maybe some Salman Rushdie magical realism or something.
Well, but it's also odd that it didn't include the fact that she went to starvation is funny given the fact that Sir John, you know, his blood vessels in his heart are bursting when he hears about his footman, you know, being fired or whatever.
Right. Or that her other husband literally drowned himself. So like there's not a, you know, there's a precedent here for dispatching yourself easily and quickly.
And it's funny that it couldn't be something that she... it's just the worst thing she could have picked, right? Yeah. I can't imagine anything else.
Right, yeah.
She died of, like, she knew that there was, you know, an outbreak of bed bugs in this place, so she threw herself upon the bed, and the bed bugs consumed her or something.
Yeah, at least then we'd be like, maybe the bed bugs were stronger back in 1897. That could have been, yeah, what do we know? I have one last note, which is the end of the book, so I don't know if there's anything else we need to discuss.
The only thing I want to ask is, because it's mentioned again, because Hugh comes from London to, like, spit on her grave. It was only a lapse of a few minutes after the widowed waif left Dunfern Mansion.
I'm sure she was a waif because she was starving to death, so.
Yeah, so I don't know, it's like, I guess good old Henry just threw her bag of bones over his shoulder.
He blew on it and it sort of rolled like a tumbleweed.
Yeah, but minutes after that, so he's just peeling off down the driveway, Hugh arrives from London. Mm-hmm. After bidding his mother quit the grounds owned by him, so I guess he sent directions ahead, like, when I get there, her corpse better be scraped off the tarmac and, you know, thrown in the garbage and throw it out in the actual truck on the street, blotted her name forever from his book of memory. And being strongly prejudiced by a father of faultless bearing, Sir John.
Yeah, right.
Resolved that the sharers of beauty, youth, and false love should never have the slightest catch on his affection. So, Hugh from London, whatever the hell he's doing in London, is a bachelor for life because there's no way. So, I don't know whether he's going to go live with that guy.
Yeah, the guy's like, wow. You finally came around.
I have so much to teach you, my son.
Ding! There's your hungry man, Hugh. Come on in.
And the day begins. Why are you putting on pants, you idiot? Yeah.
But that's the end of the book. That's how the book ends.
Yes.
And does it, so is that implying the sharers of beauty, youth, and false love should never have the slightest catch on his affection? So that's a vow of celibacy that is how the book ends?
Well, celibacy is strong. We don't
okay,
know.
Okay, sure, yeah. But just
affection.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
George Clooney, you said, like a lifelong bachelor. Wow.
Yep. I'm picturing he never, it's like sock garters. Mm-hmm. And you know, and those the big underpants, and a T-shirt with a slogan on the front of it, yeah. And yeah,
last
never takes them off.
Nacho cheese stain on the T-shirt,
for sure. And living with that guy, there's yeah, that's the end.
Wow. Oh, I gotta tell you, Hugh. Rough stuff would happen to your old lady, but if she had never starved herself to death, we would never be here watching this I Love the 90s marathon right now, and I can't think of a better way to do it. Hey, pick me up Dos Equis from the fridge when you get up. Yeah.
Will do, compadre. Oh, hang on. Let me just get this note. Oh, hey, remember that footman we fired a while back?
Oh, yeah. Well, Tom?
He was something. Like 97. The guy died.
Oh,
shit, no.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, not a happy end to the book, but I think it's the ending it deserves, you know. In fact, a very funny ending to the book, I would say.
Oh, delightful. As we said, like, not even a, you know, a glycerin tear from Hugh as he walks away, you know, like, icily from his mother's corpse or something, like, nope.
Yeah.
He
tosses a match over his shoulder and burns it to the ground.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It's so good.
Yeah, you sort of get that. What do you think the takeaway here is? What was her moral? What was she? I mean, obviously, all books had to have a moral in the old times. What do you think it was here?
I mean, I guess a false woman ruins a good man.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, it's twisted, but I think that's maybe what she was saying.
I mean, I suppose it could be you know, if it's her anniversary gift and she presents it to her husband, if she knows he's been, you know, cheating on her on business trips or something, that could be sort of her way of letting him know that she knows, type of thing. And all these tragedies befall these people.
Yeah, that could be. When you were saying that you were selling our third manor that last February, I knew you were away in London with that tart, you know, so here's your book.
Well, I could totally imagine Mark Twain and the C.S. Lewis slapping their thigh as they read about her dying of starvation in a matter of hours. So, you know, you tip my hat.
Well, it got you, right?
Oh, yeah. His oh, thank God, as he finishes his story. I mean, those are both funny moments. I'm not sure if they're as laugh out loud throughout the book as it was, but I definitely think there was some material here that would have greatly amused those old timey guys.
Yeah, I think the prose is obviously somewhat impenetrable, mm-hmm. but the plot is pretty hilarious, yes. And even the prose itself, it gets a little wearying. I would not want to read any longer.
No, yeah,
this,
yeah,
that's for
the
sure.
The length was just right.
Yeah, perfect. No, I liked it a lot.
Well, let's wrap it up with some dumb sentences.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence.
All right,
ends
so we've got some dumb
period.
Sentences here. Of course, as usual, a lot of them are submitted by our Patreon supporters, our dear beloved Tom Hepworth Patreon supporters, as opposed to
salt of the earth,
as opposed to those Rachel Hydes. Who just listen without helping out. But we appreciate them all. They get fun stuff. We get, for instance, this week we discussed our burgeoning roles as crypto guys and my attempt to convince a contractor to install an antenna on my roof to mine a cryptocurrency, which he was unable to really comprehend what I was talking about.
Labeling us crypto guys is like,
yeah, we're like someone, we're like Hugh.
Someone
when we went
mailed,
to London.
Yes, someone mailed me a helium box that I plugged in. If that makes me a crypto guy,
just start using
so
rocket ship emojis in all your correspondence, and we'll take it from
yes.
there. But yeah, so it's patreon.com/372pages. You get the episodes early. You get the bonus stuff, contests. You'll get to find out the next book before anybody else. So if that sounds good, head on over and help us out. It's really fun. We really appreciate it. First sentence, this is from Balaji, who said, "This was so bad it made me audibly gasp and pause to read it aloud to my annoyed wife." This is, we touched on it, but this is the whole context of the Dark and Stormy Night ripoff, because it was more than just once that sentence.
Okay.
"The night was dark and tempestuous, the hill rather inclined to be steep. The clouds were bathed in wrinkled furrows of vapory smoke. The traffic on the quiet and lonely road surrounding Dunfern Mansion was utterly stopped, and nature seemed a block of obstruction to the eye of the foreigner who drudged so wearily up the slope that led to the home of Mrs. Durand, who had been confined to bed for the past 3 years, a sufferer 170..." Oh, that's the... I copied that. "A sufferer from rheumatism." So I didn't pick up on that Mrs. Durand had been confined to bed for the past 3 years. Irene shows up and she starts making her breakfast and starts saying things like dinner won't be necessary. Yeah. That's even better.
You know what? You stay there moaning in pain over your rheumatism. I got dinner. I'm covered. I'll pick up a sack of 20 on the way home.
This one's from Jim. "All these thoughts seized the blighted protector of the late Colonel Iddesleigh's orphan daughter, and being gradually augmented by many others of private and public importance, rose like a tumor of superfluous matter and burst asunder on receiving the last blow relative to poor old Tom Hepworth." And his only comment was, "It didn't occur to me to this latest episode, but now I can't hear Iddesleigh without thinking it's Pig Latin for slid."
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah. Wow.
Elizabeth submitted, "Hope sinks a world of imagination." She said, "I have no idea what she's trying to slay here." Yeah, I didn't either. I wasn't, you know, hope floats. Isn't that the traditional thing that hopes do? It doesn't sink. Yes. It's the exact opposite. This was submitted by Mike. He said, "Another side of the picture of futurity presented for the anxious mother, and that was to try and obtain an interview with her son, who at this period must be a boy of some 15 summers." Mike said, "Very Kleinian. His exact age is both known to the character and the narrator, so just say he was 15.
Must be.
Mark Berger submitted, "He was tempted to invest in the polluted stocks of Magnified Extension, and when their banks seemed swollen with rotten gear, gathered too often from the winds of willful wrong, how the misty dust blinded his sense of sight and drove him through the field of fashion and feeble effeminacy, which he never once meant to tread, landing him on the slippery rock of smutty touch to wander into the hidden cavities of ancient fame, there to remain a blinded son of injustice and unparalleled wrong." It ends with an exclamation point.
God. There. What? Ponderous, man.
Yeah, really.
Ponderous.
Casey Kasem knew nothing of what that word meant. Craig submitted, "The living sometimes learn the touchy tricks of the traitor, the tardy, and the tempted. The dead have evaded the flighty earthly future and to form, to swell, the retinue of retired rites, the righteous school of the invisible, and the rebellious roar of raging nothing." And he just asked, "Pappy Pariah, is that you?"
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Dumb question. I don't think I know what the word retinue means. Does it just mean like set of something?
Yeah, I think so. I would not be able to use it in a sentence, but I've heard it before and would have thought before this I would have been able to tell you what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I just having someone use it, I'm always like, is there another word? Yeah. Because retinue, come on, yeah. We don't use that anymore.
A group of, anyway, a group I don't of feel advisors, assistants, or others accompanying an important in person. The rock stars.
Oh, retinue, like a set of people helping.
An entourage,
okay.
Yeah.
An entourage, okay.
This was submitted by three separate people, Chap, Arthur, and Amanda. But President O'Sullivan, this is another long one, whose well-guided words and fatherly advice had on this evening so sealed the mind of forgiveness with the wax of disinterested intent that Sir John, on his arrival home, at once sent for his solicitors, Messrs. Hutchinson and Harper, and ordering his will to be produced, demanded there and then that the pen of persuasion be dipped into the ink of revenge and spread thickly along the paragraph of blood-related charity to blank the intolerable words that referred to the woman he was now convinced, beyond doubt, had braved the bridge of bigamy. And I think this was...
You know that C.S. Lewis spilled his IPA at the Eagle and Claw when Tolkien read that one out loud to him. So.
Chap's comment was, Tyra Banks may have been a little too proud of her adverbs, but how much irrational self-confidence is required to encourage someone to poke the word of six times into a single sentence?
Wow. Yeah.
And last one was from Hayden. Drawing forth of a chair beside the beside of the August patient, Hugh, quite unprepared, received the awful intelligence of his mother's conduct and life from the lips of the afflicted, who, in broken accents, related the tale of trouble for which years had kept him a prisoner to its influence. And Hugh just says, how many accents did he try, I wonder?
That was at Fanny's door, right, where she had the accents?
Was it also?
The weakened... No, I think she tried her weakened accent at Fanny's door, huh. Too. So it was a thing she had.
She had been abroad for a while, so it was probably like the spring break thing of coming back where she's talking in a New York accent. So she's like, hey, you know, Fanny, I'm knocking here twice.
Our own Sean Thomason goes back to the Hollers in Virginia and says he has to fight his accent when he comes back. So, yeah. Yeah, you get it.
Yeah. Do you have any that we have not touched on?
I think I do. Please stop me if this was read, because I was kind of looking over my notes at some of them. But I think this is new. There she was, a stranger in a foreign land. That's a nice cliche. An outcast to the society she shone so brilliantly amongst during years that were now no more. The fostered orphan, the adopted daughter of heiress nothing, the wife of devotional distinction, the illegal partner of crutchy poverty, and the penniless widow of undeniable woe.
God.
I think it was crutchy poverty that made me pick that one out. It's pretty good.
It does sound like a video a hospital would show to some sick kids where it's like, hey, kids, I'm crutchy. You don't have to be afraid to walk around with me. I'm friendly. I help you get better.
Crutchy
and casty.
Yes. But I had many more, but I think they were kind of covered, and a lot of them are just that kind of that long thing where you go, oh my
god. Yeah, it is. It's just the semicolons and commas, and it makes them dumb by virtue of just their pure construction, no matter what they say. My one that didn't get burnt was, this is when Oscar is trying to find Irene. I think, you know, before he killed himself, he was, you know, she was.
Who's Irene now?
God. Hi. Oh, man. We've got five more minutes.
I know. Sorry, go ahead.
Oscar says his various inquiries regarding her whereabouts proved vain as the vanishing shadow of Venus. Just it's a settle down, dumb sentence. You know,
what does that?
I don't know.
What does that mean?
Venus had probably been discovered the year before, and she was trying to like make some cool like topical references to it.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of like the you know, Venus women's razor is now my context for it.
Yeah. It's a planet. I mean, that's a pretty well known.
That's how far down the road I am of modernity.
All right. Well, those are dumb sentences. We do have some emails we can read pretty quickly.
We're going to the party. We're going to the game. We're going to the disco. We're going to cruise out, man.
All right, these are emails. A lot of them also from our beloved, beloved Patreon supporters.
Ah, they're such Hepworths, all of them. I mean,
they'd be our footmen any day.
Yes.
First one is from Lucas. As promised, the real or fanfic statistics are in. Mike scored 7 out of 10. So that 70% puts your total average at 58.39%, an increase of 39%. So, I mean, it takes a
lot. Oh, the percentage increase is huge. But, yeah, it is like a baseball team trying to reach their magic number. Yeah. It's just so hard.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, if you had gotten a 10 out of 10, it might have raised your average thing by like 0.6%. So it's a hard road ahead at this point in time. But, you know, it's an improvement, and for that we – Lucas says, I wish there was nothing more to say, but unfortunately, not much to talk about for books this short.
Right. All right. Well, if short books help me, let's just do short books.
Elizabeth said, I just have to mention how ironic it is this book full of incredibly horrible relationships was published as an anniversary present. Why didn't she bother to have at least one good marriage to compare Irene's poor choices to? Makes me wonder how happy she was at home. Maybe she was writing this book from her own murder room. She did write more books, so you know, you never know what happened there. Maybe the footman's the villain of the next one. Doug said Sir John's deathbed monologue to his son would have been shorter and less convoluted if he'd recapped all seven seasons of Lost. I agree. He also probably would have said, oh, thank God, when that was all over, too. I think that was my reaction yes. when we turned off the TV when Lost was done.
Yes.
We get this. This was sort of disappointing because I thought it was so perfect, but it is... I'm going to share it anyway. This is from Ben. Listening to Connor's skepticism about 1800s humor reminded me of this joke published the same year as Irene Iddesley. It's called The Best Gorilla Joke of 1897.
It's called that?
Yeah, it has a big title. Gorilla. Okay. Did you hear about the gorilla who escaped from the zoo? Zookeeper. No, I did not. Gorilla. That is because I am a quiet gorilla. Parenthetical. Muffled sounds of gorilla violence. And I said, that is hilarious. I of course, looked it up, and it is not from 1897. It's from a Tumblr post from November of 2020.
Okay.
But the year being the same is pretty damn crazy. I mean.
Someone trying to cast their mind back to insult the jokes.
This is from Emily. She is currently reading Vladimir Nabokov's Ada. And she says, have a quote. I am sentimental, she said. I could dissect a koala, but not its baby. I like the words damsel, eglantine, elegant. I love when you kiss my elongated white hand. And she says, slender fingers are everywhere.
Wow.
I found some in a book I was reading, a nonfiction book. I was reading Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire, and he's talking about weed. He says, its purplish green leaves are shorter and rounder than the long, slender fingers of sativa.
What the hell?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's pretty.
Even weed has long hands. Amazing.
Yeah. I have a couple more. I got somehow off of the emails right now. So listeners Don and Mike wrote in. We decided to explore some other works of Amandra McKittrick-Ross and happened upon her collection of poetry. It appeared to her she had a great disdain for lawyers, and many of the poems excoriate lawyers of her acquaintance with particular attention to their physical shortcomings. So maybe that's why those lawyers were not explained to be of the most honorable, and only the doctors were. But
I was trying to come up with their names here. I got to get them down in my mind. I'll look through my notes. But go on.
But this, the last people should look into them because they are pretty funny. Buttocks getting whipped with fishing hooks, stuff like that. But the finally he says one of them said in what must surely be the best opening line of all of literature. The poem is called Eastertide, and the opening line is, "Dear Lord, the day of eggs is here."
Wow.
Which I think I told them would be like a chilling first line of a Shirley Jackson book or something.
Wow. And the construction is perfect. Day of eggs.
Yes, yes. Or Ray Bradbury. That is a funny... comes across, every 30 years, the day of eggs, and everyone, the eggs come and kill people.
That's a funny thing that in my household, I make eggs for my wife only when she wants them. Mm. And I will say, is today an egg day? And she will say yes or no based on that. And then I will make the eggs. And then I, like a chef, you call out, I will say eggs up. And she has to respond because she's in another room because otherwise the eggs get cold, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah.
So when I started speaking French, practicing French, I would call it out as, in French, it's the day of the eggs on a plate is basically what you say. And she would respond, oui, merci, and that would be, but the construction is the same, day of eggs.
Amazing.
That's what I would say in French.
Maybe she...
And I think I said that this morning, yeah.
So next time you bolt upright... You'll have to, next time you awake with a start.
Awake with a start.
You'll have to say, dear Lord, the day of eggs is here.
La journée de la ouf de la plate.
Janelle wrote in to inform us that a user on Discord named Jorkily found out that the longest sentence in the book was, what's your guess here? How many words?
Well, I'm looking at one of my dumb sentences. I'm going to say, let's see, how many... No, I'm not going to cheat. I'm going to just say 65 words.
128 words.
Wow. Okay.
It begins, what must have been the breathless surprise of Lady Dilworth chiefly. So I guess it's from the beginning of the book when she was still Lady Dilworth and not not the widow.
Well, the very beginning of the book is Hugh getting the...
Oh, of course. That well-known guy.
Getting castle taken.
Yeah, he's living there in his bachelorhood. That's what we described. He turned into the neighbor on Office Space and is heating up his hungry man of walnuts. Last email I'm going to read here. Maybe we can do a bonus with other things, other emails. But this was from Erin. She said, I'm sure you've gotten several emails about the Irene is a portrait theory that the Patreon Discord jackals cooked up. I did not see any more emails to that effect, but the theory, I guess, is that he observed her portrait on that first thing, because that's how he knew her, by the great artist Pito. And then the rest of the book was just his hallucination of this beautiful woman he saw in a portrait.
But why?
Because that's what people do. They take theories and then they expand upon them. For, she says, I like this theory a little too much, in fact, and the result is that I wrote an 8,500 word fanfic based on the theory. If you don't want...
85, that's like probably the length of the book, right?
Yeah, it's probably like three sentences. She said, if you don't want to read the whole thing, and why would you? Here's a spoiler-free synopsis. A starving artist named Pito obtains magical powers. I'm going to post the link for people who are interested in reading a 8,500 word Irene Isley fanfic by Erin. So enjoy that if you do.
Wow. Okay. I don't know. I just don't know why the theory.
So Pito obtains magical powers, allows him to charm the viewer of his works into thinking he's a great artist. He paints portraits for the wealthy and gains the acclaim he always sought. While painting Irene's portrait, he becomes obsessed with her and uses a magical power that binds him and his work subject together until the portrait is destroyed. The real Irene is trapped inside her own portrait until the Irene everyone sees and interacts is just a vision. The vision of Irene is controlled by those around her, including her parents, Sir John, Marjorie, and Oscar. Why? I still can't answer you. But people have theories like in Starship Troopers, like the bug attack was just a false flag planted by the government.
Sure.
Why you would spend your time on Earth defending Starship Troopers as a work of satire and coming up with things that are not present on screen in any way or even hinted at to defend that crazy theory? I don't know, but that's what people do.
All right, well, let's make a movie on it, like the one on Kubrick.
Oh, yeah, Room 237.
Shining.
Yep.
237.
Yeah, it's that type of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
The Calumet making powder means that he faked the moon landing.
Sure.
And then we can make a YouTube series that's like it's a picture of us sort of like smirking with our arms out, and it has a weird background, and it's part one of 33. Irene portrait theory explained.
That's our ticket to retirement. I assume.
I think so. That's how we get set for life with $1,000 and don't have to take a public school job.
Okay, I'll take that pathetic $500 a month job. Excuse me while I go slink back and eat cup of noodles.
Well, where do you put this one? I think it's up there. I think it's below some of the other crazy, weird Amazon self-published tomes we've read. Below Moon People, below DDT, below Dwight. Below Jim Tice, of course. But I don't know.
Yeah. Yes, I would put it below that. Put it below Trucking Through Time. A strong finisher. I'd certainly put it above. I don't know, three quarters, 75% of our material. Yep. I think it's better than most.
Yeah, I think so. I will.
Its brevity, of course, is on its side.
Absolutely, yep. The fact that she was trying something, this is what she took her gift and did. She got an opportunity that nobody was afforded. That, if Amazon publishing had existed then, who knows how many other crazy people would have done stuff. But she had this opportunity. This is what she chose to say to the world. Makes that to me, there's no pretense about it. There's no irony or anything. She just aired the grievances, and boy, did she.
Yes. Yeah, there is something about that when someone really strives and they just don't have it. Because it's, again, not a slam on their character or anything. It's just like she just is not a talented writer. But it's great to see someone grasping for something, and there's no reason not to be delighted by their failures in that. Yeah. So it was pretty fun.
Great. Well, thanks everyone who took the ride with us, everyone who listened along without reading, everyone on Patreon who supports us. We'll hit you back with something new soon, but stay tuned, and we'll be in touch. We will try to make it, won't we?
Thank you all. Speaking of obscure references, so long, everyone.
Bye.